Blog Talk Radio.
Can't tell me life was meant to be like this. A black man in a world dominated by whiteness. Ever since the Declaration of Independence, we've been easily brainwashed by just one sentence. It goes, all men are created equal. That's why corrupt governments kill innocent people. With chemical warfare, they created crack and AIDS. Got the public thinking these were things that black folks made. And every time there's violence shown in the media, usually it's a black thing. So where are they leading you? To a world full of ignorance, hatred and prejudice. TV and the news for years, they're prejudiced. Foolish notion that blacks are all criminals, violent lowlifes, and then even animals. I'm telling the truth, so some suckers are fearing me, but I must do my part to combat the conspiracy.
School, education,
the SAT is not geared for the lower class, so why waste time even trying to pass? The educational system presumes you to fail. The next place is the corner, then after that, jail. You gotta understand that this has all been confined to put a strain on our brains so that the strong grow tired. It even exists when you go to your church, cause up on the wall a white Jesus lurks. They use your subconscious to control your will. They've done it for a while and developed a skill to make you wanna kill even your own brother, man. Black against black, you see, it's part of their plan. They wanna send us to war and they wanna ban rap. What they really wanna do is get rid of us blacks. Genocide is for real, and I hope that you're hearing me. You must be aware to combat the conspiracy.
In the art business, in industry,
even in this rap game, all that glitters ain't gold. Now the rap is big business, the snakes got bold. They give you whack contracts and try to make you go pop, cause they have no regard for real hip hop. They'll compare you to others and say, but yo, he sells. And you know in your heart that he's weak as hell. So you say, I ain't doing that corny stuff. But they tell you that your chart positions will go up. Sometimes they front big time and make you many promises. And then when they break them, that's when your mama says, son, you're making records, but that guy seems shady. It could be too late, and your career could be flaky. I hope you listen to the things that I'm sharing, see. We all have a job to combat the conspiracy.
And that was Guru, the great Guru, rest in peace, of the unbelievable hip-hop group Gangsta, Guru and Primo, with Conspiracy. And I am Solomon Kamajan. I'm your host of Your World News, and welcome to another fabulous edition of Your World News. This is a tribute to the late, great Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and throughout this program, we're going to put in perspective Dr. King's life, especially placing particular emphasis on the last 2.5-3 years of his life, that somehow, many reasons, the mainstream corporate media, mainstream public educational systems in America continue to obfuscate and bury as far as they possibly can into their annals of mental programming. So we're going to be deconstructing Dr. King, placing him in a more vivid context. And we're also going to be placing Dr. King and his words and his life in general into the context of 2011. Looking at the man who was taken away from us on April 4th, 1968, and, you know, what he stood for, and really looking into what he stood for at that time and what perhaps he would think of 2011, from everything from the Obama administration to greater context, looking at Americanism, you know, American military exploits throughout the globe, the military-industrial complex, the prison-industrial complex, rampant poverty caused by just rapacious, unfettered capitalism, and so forth. And so we've got a great show. Peter is about to join us from Glendale, Arizona, Peter Fowler. And we're going to be speaking to John Judge, who's a scholar, one of the, I would say, without doubt, one of the preeminent scholars and researchers, especially when it comes to political assassinations within this country. And so he's going to be really breaking down to the very last compound the context in terms of why Dr. King, why so many wanted him dead, wanted him assassinated, why he was assassinated, the players, and he's going to be breaking it down. You know, why James Earl Ray was not just not the lone gunman, but was not the gunman whatsoever. So it's going to be an information filled show. And so before I even bring Peter on, I want to have Dr. King, you know, kick us off, and I want everyone to listen. This is a snippet from a snippet from 1967, a year before the day that a year to the day in which he was assassinated. And this is at Riverside Baptist Church. This is the speech that they don't want you to hear. This is the speech that they don't. This is why they drive down your throat. And often in incomplete context, the speech he gave on the mall in 1963, they'll shove that down your throat. You know, the content of the character, not the color of the skin, and they'll drive that down school kids' throats constantly. But this is not right here. This is not the speech that they want you and I and your children, our children, children throughout America to know about Dr. King and his work and what he fought so hard for. So I'm just going to play this, and then we'll be joined by Peter Fowler. We'll get going. But without further ado, here is the late, great Dr. Martin Luther King.
A time comes when silence is betrayal. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom and in the surrounding world. And some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that the calling to speak is often a vocation of agony. But we must speak. We must speak with all the humility that is appropriate to our limited vision. But we must speak. I've chosen to preach about the war today because I agree with Dante that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. Now, of course, one of the difficulties in speaking out today grows out of the fact that there are those who are seeking to equate dissent with disloyalty. It's a dark day in our nation when high-level authorities will seek to use every method to silence dissent. And I say that those who are seeking to make it appear that anyone who opposes the war is a fool or a traitor or an enemy of our soldiers is a person who has taken a stand against the best in our tradition. There will be no meaningful solution until some attempt is made to know these people and hear their broken cry. And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. We are called to speak for the weak, for the voiceless, for the victims of our nation, and for those it calls enemy. For no document from human hands can make these humans any less our brothers. We are met by a deep but understandable mistrust. To speak for them is to explain this lack of confidence in Western words, and especially their distrust of American intentions now. Now that is little left to build on save bitterness. The world now demands a maturity of America that we may not be able to achieve. I am as deeply concerned about our own troops there as anything else, for it occurs to me that what we are submitting them to is not simply the brutalizing process that goes on in any war where armies face each other and seek to destroy. We are adding cynicism to the process of death, for they must know after the short period there that none of the things we claim to be fighting for are really involved. And the more sophisticated surely realize that we are on the side of the wealthy and the secure while we create a hell for the poor. Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. This way of settling differences is not just. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as one who loves America, to the leaders of our own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours.
And that was the late, great Dr. Martin Luther King. And, you know, it listen to that over and over again, whether it's your first time or whether it's the 100th time you've heard that. You know, just any part of that speech, it can't, you can't not, to use a, you know, double negative, you can't not, you know, get chills and goosebumps, you know, down your arms, down your back, down your legs. It's very, very powerful talk. And in an era right now when we see 77% of Americans living check to check and 46 plus million Americans on food stamps and limited food stamps, and more you know, people running out of their unemployment insurance, and you know, that's very tenuous, as we know. You know, the extension is only, you know, 18 months, and that was the compromise to benefit the rich. We see that things in the U.S. have gotten much worse since Dr. King gave that speech. Things have gotten much worse. And, you know, so I think that it's so appropriate that we honor Dr. King, not just on this day, not simply because the symbolism behind this day being a federal holiday. We know that his birthday, his real true birthday, was the 15th, but it really, we could use Dr. King as a backdrop for any one of our shows when it comes to some of the great ills that plague the globe and obviously plague America in general, because many of those ills start. The epicenter is the good U.S. of A. You know, when we look at a lot of the world's ills, you know, the USA is wrapped up in globalism and imperialism and the militarism that he talked about, you know, having anywhere from 746 military bases to perhaps over 1,000 military bases, you know, depending on which estimates you look at. Nonetheless, it's a tremendous number, spanning over 136 different countries. It's you know. So, anyways, without further ado, I want to bring Peter on so he can introduce himself to you. And Peter, if you can give us, you know, a couple of thoughts on the late great Dr. Martin Luther King.
Absolutely, Solomon. Good to be with you again. I, for one, do get chills every time I hear Dr. King. And around this time, usually throughout the whole month of January every year, I listen to audio recordings of a number of his speeches and sermons and so forth. And no matter how many times I hear Dr. King speak, every time I hear him, I am deeply, deeply affected. And, you know, that sermon or speech that you played a clip from, it's and I'm glad that you opened with that clip. And it was a sermon in the sense that it was delivered from a pulpit at Riverside Church in New York City, but it was a speech in the sense that it was more of a political statement and a personal commentary than any kind of biblical exegetical proclamation, traditionally what we think of as a sermon. So when we talk about that speech, Time to Break Silence, that he delivered on 4 April 1967, we can see that this was probably the day in which he sealed his fate. This particular address is probably the one that sealed his fate as an enemy of the state and facilitated his assassination exactly 1 year later. And when I say an enemy of the state, I do not mean an enemy of the Commonwealth of citizens of the United States, but obviously I mean something else. I mean the corporate-dominated state and the regressive political forces that dominated American politics in the late 1960s and continue to now dominate American politics in the 21st century, if possible to an even greater degree than they did in 1967 and 1968. And that clip from that address articulates what is a radical side of Martin Luther King. And, you know, that's the direction that we're going to go in tonight on this show. And we'll come back to a number of those different elements. And it's well that we do that, because given that this is the MLK holiday, We have to recognize that the Martin Luther King Day has become a yearly ritual, basically to turn black radicals, including King, into, you know, these red, white, and blue icons. You know, these great American heroes that get wrapped up in the flag and get wrapped up in, you know, all these constitutional catchphrases and so on and so forth. King was something radically different than the caricature of him that Michael Eric Dyson calls him, the Santa Clausification of Martin Luther King. This caricature of King as this harmless, just pacifist, you know, who just wanted black folks and white folks to get together and hold hands and sing songs. That's what the state has turned him into. And so, you know, it's our job tonight. And any time we talk about the memory of Martin Luther King and his legacy, his theology, his ethics, is to confront that and to address it and correct it. So I'm excited about tonight. I'm excited about the opportunity to get to talk with John Judge and discuss some of the details of the King assassination and for us to break down King a little more clearly and with a little more accuracy and relevancy. So it's good that we do this tonight. And it has far-reaching implications beyond January, beyond the King holiday, beyond any particularities. But King's theology and ethics and methodology is something that we need to be mindful of on an ongoing basis. So, having said that, I'm looking forward to getting into all those things and more tonight.
Yeah, definitely. And he brought up something in that piece that it seems like every time I catch something, more and more that is put into deeper perspective. But, you know, as you know, Peter, we've had these discussions. And let me not be remiss. You know, after our interview with John Judge, he'll be joining us in about 10 minutes. But after our interview, if people want to call in with their thoughts, their comments on Dr. King, on the relevance of Dr. King's message in 2011, please do so. Our number is 347-945-5191. Once again, that's 347-945-5191. And please, we ask that everyone that's listening right now, when the show is completed, because as you know, you can listen to the show on archive, please send the link to this show to all of your friends, networks, family members, loved ones. This is history. This is history that they're not supposed to get, and that's why it's all the more important that you give them this history, because this history can and does change people's lives in terms of how they look at the role they play within this American society. So please make sure that you pass the pass the link along. But as Peter and I have had this conversation before, going back to lead up to the 2008 election, I've made it no secret I didn't vote for Barack Obama. And if you're living within a small constrained box, you'll immediately think that I voted for John McCain, because that's the box that they place us within, So if you don't vote for a Democrat, you must have voted for a Republican. That's the way they want us to think. Well, no, that's not the case. I voted for Cynthia McKinney, who was presidential candidate for the Green Party. And as you know, she spent 12 years in Congress as a Democratic congresswoman from the state of Georgia. But I voted for her. I could not vote for Barack Obama, because he had already revealed himself to be in support of this war. He had voted for FISA. He had beat his chest. The war drum is very proud that he supported Israel and their unwarranted strikes on Tyre, Lebanon, in the southern part of Lebanon. And I've been, and Peter has as well, and other folks across this country that didn't vote for Barack Obama for these same reasons have been justified, because he has become the warmonger that he told his voters that he was going to. They thought that he was coming in, and, and a lot of folks just didn't want to read the tea leaves. I mean, he was putting them out there for everybody, but they just seemingly, I don't know why, but they seemingly continue to think that he was going to contract the war in Afghanistan. He said the total opposite, that he had plans to expand the war in Afghanistan, which he has by 48,000 troops. I think they just recently approved another 1,800 troops into Afghanistan. That's for every standing troop in Afghanistan. That is between $900,000 and $1 million per troop, per soldier per year. That's where our money is going to. And as Dr. King said, a country that spends more money on military than it does on programs of social uplift, is headed for a spiritual doom. And so we look at Peter, what he said in that little tidbit that we just played. One of the things that stuck out is that you have to speak out. This is what I got. You have to speak out. When you know of wrong that's going on, you really, in essence, become complicit with the crimes that are going on in your name, through your tax dollars. You without speaking
right.
out, when you choose to continue to support, just because you voted for Barack Obama does not mean that you have to continue to support him. You can take it as a loss. I made the wrong choice. Not that I should have voted for, that you should have voted for McCain either, but you can take the loss and now work for justice, work for peace, and say, I was wrong, and I gave him my vote. I gave you my vote, and I was wrong. You're a warmonger. You are carrying out many of the same policies as George Bush did, and I was duped. Many of us were duped. But I'm going to work on the side of peace and justice right now. And so, I get a lot of that. That the more we keep our mouths shut and continue to support this administration and in general to support the continuation, which has gone on long before Barack Obama, gone on long before George Bush, but the continued military exploits of the United States government, you know, which has continued to rob us of so many programs that could help a great number of people. I mean, clearly, if we even cut back military expenditure by 50%, we could completely, as you know this, Peter, completely wipe out, eradicate poverty as we know it in America.
Right. Yeah, and you know the way you just framed the current political climate, it's appropriate for us to be looking at that address from April 4th, 1967, which King entitled "Time to Break Silence," because like you just noted, there's so many people who now are keeping silent or are continue to support Obama. And what we see with King in April of 1967 and afterwards is, you know, he was wrestling with his patriotism. You know, I mean, early in his career, you know, all throughout the civil rights movement, he talks about trying to actualize the ideals of the American experiment in democracy. You know, equality and justice and so on and so forth. Yet by 1967, he gets to a point where he has to break silence with his realization that America does not practice what she preaches, okay? And we're in the same boat today. You know, America is not practicing what she preaches. You know, America claims to be about democracy, yet everything that America does in terms of domestic and foreign policy is anti-democratic. You know, we don't have to look very far off the shores of the United States to see that. We just look at Haiti as one example, and you and I have dissected that on other shows. And all around the globe, through every decade of the 20th century, and now even in the 21st century, the United States has been anti-democratic. And King, you know, got to a point where he could not be silent about that anymore. And so he, you know, he speaks out very clearly, very eloquently, and very powerfully in that Time to Break Silence address about those revelations about the United States that he had come to and how he had to speak out against them. And just a couple of them, you know, militarism, you know, he spoke out about that throughout the last year of his life. You know, and he refers to it in that speech as, you know, this way of settling disputes, right? You know, we have to turn that around. And he was talking specifically about war as a first alternative for settling international disputes, okay? And that goes back to that myth of redemptive violence that, you know, is a core ideal or virtue of Americanism, that violence is the thing that solves disputes, whether it's between individuals or whether it's between geopolitical entities on a larger scale, countries, nations, entire continents, and so forth. You know, and then another thing that he says is a little more subtle, but very powerful, and I think was another thing that riled up the establishment. He says that we need to get to know these people, referring to the Vietnamese. Now think about that for just a minute. The American foreign policy requires that we, in the 1960s and early 70s, thought about the Vietnamese as just the enemy, as just, you know, these brown-skinned guerrilla warfare thugs. Here we are in the 21st century, and it's the same concept, it's just in a different part of the world. Now it's Iraqis and Afghans, and you know, broadly speaking, Arabs and Muslims, whether it's Palestine or Iraq or Iran, and we just need to, as long as we think about them as the enemy, and, you know, they hate us. They, you know, it's the they and the us, and it's the we and the them. You know, that was a powerful statement that the King made. And if we were to think about Afghans and Iraqis today as individuals and as human beings, and just pause for a moment to think about what we're doing to other human beings on a global scale, I think that is a crucial first step in coming to understand what the United States is doing and begin to really critique foreign policy, like right. King did. So, you know, that's right. It's very timely. It's very timely.
Right, and I'm glad you mentioned Vietnamese, because, you know, folks have, you know, the U.S. history is totally, you know, told from the perspective especially when they look at wars and the U.S.'s engagement in war and warfare, and it's told from the perspective of the U.S., which much of the time has been from the perspective of the imperialist, you know, the oppressor, if you will. And right as I'm about to put John Judge in, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because when you look at the Vietnam War, Ho Chi Minh, you know, has been sold to us. You know, he's sold. If you're taught U.S. history from a very limited perspective, and you allow yourself to continue to be taught from a limited perspective, you will see Ho Chi Minh as this evil guy. But the way I look at him, he was a liberator. He was a freedom fighter for his people. He was a liberator for his people, and you know, they were under the yoke of the French. You know, he rallied, you know what I'm saying, his people. They booted the French out on their asses, you know, and you know, which was a colonizing nation. The French had colonized them, and you know, much like the U.S. claimed that they were going to the Philippines to liberate the Filipinos from the Spaniards. They went in there and they just exchanged roles. They became the colonizer, you know, once the Spanish were gone. But I want to read this quote from Dr. King regarding Vietnam. I'm glad you put it in that perspective, Peter, juxtaposing how most Americans looked at Vietnam in the late 50s, 60s, and certainly the 70s, and even to this day, and putting it into context with how most Americans look at Afghani people. So, you know, this is what Dr. King said, quote, the Vietnamese people proclaimed their own independence in 1945 after a combined French and Japanese occupation and before the Communist Revolution in China. They were led by Ho Chi Minh. Even though they quoted the American Declaration of Independence in their own document of freedom, we refused to recognize them. Instead, we decided to support France in its reconquest of her former colony. That's very, very deep and goes totally against the grain, because we know that Lyndon Baines Johnson, much of the Vietnam War was under his watch. And so when Dr. King came out, he was totally willing to burn bridges with those in the White House rather than being silent. You know, he decided, I'd rather burn bridges and take a stand for justice than to remain quiet and to allow those who follow me throughout this country to continue to be obfuscated by the U.S. policy in this war. I'm going to speak out. I'm going to speak truth to justice, I'm going to speak truth to so-called power, and I'm going to, I'm going to speak it, you know, loud and clear. And that's exactly what he did. Without a doubt, we're going to get into more of that after our interview. But for the next hour, we're going to have a very powerful hour. See, John Judge is on the line. I'm about to pass him through in one moment, and I've had the pleasure of knowing John Judge for the last several years. And as I said before, he's one of the great researchers of our time. And don't feel bashful that you don't know of him. You will know of him and his website by the time he gets off the air. But most people that you might want to bring into your organization, your school, or your community to talk about different issues, you're not going to know about. You're going to hear about all the other folks, the ones that get paraded across, paraded across MSNBC, Fox News, CNBC, ABC, CNN. Those are the ones that you're supposed to know about. Most public speakers, most people that are researchers that can come in and put things into a perspective that you need to know, most people don't know about. And John Judge, without a doubt, is one of those. I had him come in to an organization that I was part of, and he broke down the history of the Pentagon and how it's it has been just an oppressive tool within communities of color for a long, long time. And I mean, but he even broke it down even more broadly. I mean, got into his upbringing, which is very much rooted in the Pentagon, and you know, he's like I said, he's one of the exquisite researchers, just meticulous in his work. And he used to work. He was a staffer for Cynthia McKinney, and helped write, you know, a piece of legislation that was introduced to the floors of Congress to reopen the King file. So I'm going to put him through. John, you're on the air right now. If you can just kind of open up before I ask you the first question, if you can let our listeners know a little bit of your bio, who you are, how you came to be, and because I think it's an interesting story in terms of your mother working for the Pentagon, you being very familiar with the Pentagon for a long time, and how you basically were pulled into a lot of the work that drives you to this day, a lot of the work you do in communities, going especially into mostly communities of color, and working towards making sure that black and brown skin high school students and even middle school students know as much about their alternatives post-high school as they do, you know, with the military. So he does a lot of counter-military work so that, you know, because we know a lot of poor people, a lot of people of color, kids of color are forced into military action, military duty based on their social conditions, and John does a lot of work with that. So, John, could you kind of give us a little snapshot of your history?
Sure. Thanks, Solomon. I grew up in the suburbs of D.C. My mother and father and my aunt worked at the Pentagon. My mother was actually the highest paid woman employee there for many years, five levels above top security. She had access to the war room for briefings. And even though she had worked there in response to the threat of Hitler in World War II, she had been a pacifist between World War I and World War II. And some of that anti-war sentiment crept back in when she saw the civilian deaths and the napalm in the Vietnam period. So I grew up actually going to the Pentagon as a young person, going into their library quite often, being dropped off. And while there was nothing classified in there, there were things you wouldn't see in a public library. I loved to read and research, and I began work looking into the war in Vietnam, which led me into some of these political assassinations in the early 60s, and came out against the war in Vietnam by 64, and did work on my campus against the war, and also was a draft counselor and then a GI and veterans counselor during the Vietnam period, came to understand what was going on. And then the veterans started coming back and telling the real story about Vietnam. In 68, I began bringing them into high schools in Dayton, Ohio, where I was, so that the young people could find out about the war that they were being faced with, and in many cases dragged into by the Selective Service system. And I continued that anti-militarism work up to the present day. I worked as a counselor with Central Committee for Conscientious Objector and trained other counselors around the country in draft law and military law, and did military organizing actually during the end period of the war, organizing active duty people and veterans against the war. And I go into the high schools, have been in D.C. since 1985, with veterans and military family members with a counter-recruitment message and with alternatives for people that face what I call a poverty draft. In the course of doing that reading and research, I read a critical book about the Kennedy assassination about 68, and I was still in college, and I began to read the 26 volumes of the Warren Commission that were in my college library. And try to compare them to the report and realize that they didn't match. And I lived through that period when the political assassinations made such a difference in terms of the direction of this country, who would be in charge, what kind of policies we'd have here and abroad, what chances we had for peace or international cooperation or not, to what extent the rise of the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned about, and in his original draft he called it the military-industrial intelligence complex, was affected by these assassinations of people who were opposing the war in Vietnam in Kennedy's case, pulling out of Vietnam, normalizing relations with Cuba in a back channel, ending the Cold War, stopping the arms race, and basically reversing the control that the Joint Chiefs and the Pentagon had had up to that point. His brother similarly stood up against the war before he was killed. Martin Luther King took his position at Riverside Church 1 year to the day before he was shot down in Memphis against the war in Vietnam. And actually the first anti-war demonstration in Harlem was organized by Malcolm X and people in community organizations up there. And that was quite early. It was about 65, as I remember. So all of these people had challenged the system and challenged the militarism of the system. And you know, I was part of the anti-war movement in the 60s, and we effectively stopped a war in Vietnam, in part, but also stopped a wider war that was planned into Laos and Cambodia and the entire sector, and made that impossible through our resistance at home as well as on the field in Vietnam when the GIs revolted to the point that they had to give up on the war. And the Vietnamese themselves listed as the second major reason for the defeat of the American forces there, the first being the struggle of the people themselves, the second was the American GI movement against the war, and third was international solidarity. So it was critical to ending that war. And, you know, I've continued to do that work and to try to prevent and counter the current wars that we're involved in, which are based on just as much deception and colonial purpose as the others. None of the wars that the United States has been involved in have been defensive wars in my lifetime. And I think you could even make an argument that World War II, despite the attack by the Japanese, was still, in its broader context, not a defensive war. I think the, you know, the weapons that we've developed over the years, the militarization of the society, including the police, have had a tremendously negative effect. So I do research, I do investigation, I've written and lectured, and after I studied the Kennedy assassination, I was affected by Dr. King's death the day after. I went out with a sign that said, "The King of Love is dead," and I followed up on that and went to Memphis, saw the scene, and realized that, again, the official story we were given was a false one. And in the 1990s, I began an organization, Committee for an Open Archives, to get the files loose on the various political assassinations. And I worked with other researchers that were part of opening up the House Select Committee on investigations in the 70s, have been trying to get at some kind of a fair hearing or justice in these cases for some time. In 94, I was one of the major people involved in starting the National Coalition on Political Assassinations, or COPA, that I still head up, and we have regular meetings with the latest forensic and ballistic and historical evidence in these various major political assassinations that have affected the culture. One thing a lot of people don't recall is that in the period in the late 20s and early 30s in Weimar Republic in Germany, and the period prior to the rise of Hitler and the Nazi Party, there were a series of 400 political assassinations of labor leaders, musicians, political activists, people who dissented, university professors who spoke out or taught an alternate history, and people on the left. And they singled these people out for assassination. The Weimar Republic police said that they were politically motivated, but they couldn't solve them. 400 assassinations they couldn't solve. And these were done in large part by a veterans group from World War I called the Freikorps, which became one of the main groups that fed into the creation of the Brown Shirts and the National Socialist Party there in Germany, and helped rise Hitler to power in a vacuum of silence And similarly, we see right up to the current day political assassinations going on that silence progressive voices in this country. But certainly the hope that was held out for change by the Kennedy brothers, by Malcolm, by Martin Luther King, was part of what they were killing in those years.
Right.
And I've just been an investigator and studied it and tried to get at the truth and get the truth out.
Right. We appreciate that. First question I want to start off with, and Peter will ask you the next question, but I wanted to kind of, and I think you touched on a little bit of the framework of the civil rights movement, but I wanted to look at, you know, the juxtaposition of Martin and Malcolm X, the evolution of King's politics by 1967, because, you know, around that time, that's when he really fully had a bullseye on him, you know, if not before that. But and then also, if you could touch on, because I think when we look at that bullseye, we have to look at the context. So if you could touch on COINTELPRO, which is the counterintelligence program, which a lot of folks have heard of, but a lot of folks haven't heard of CHAOS and Lantern Spike, which is part and parcel of the response of the FBI, CIA, military intelligence, and not just on King, but also the black leadership. And then, you know, within that, King's message on racism, poverty, and militarization as part of his growing agenda by that point.
Well, King certainly came out of the civil rights movement in that period, as did Malcolm, from different frameworks, but certainly lived in communities that faced in the North and the South problems of overt racism. And you know, Malcolm's background, of course, was living on the streets and being arrested as a petty criminal and spending time in prison and then being converted in prison to the black Muslims and Elijah Muhammad. And he became a right hand to Muhammad until he felt that there was hypocrisy involved there and called out against it. King came up through the Southern black church response to much of this, and the foundations, the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and movements in the South, even among elements of the white community, to address the racism that was going on there. And neither of them existed in a vacuum, neither came up entirely by themselves, but they became recognized as leaders within a broader movement to try to change the segregationist policies and the racist policies that were going on in their communities, whether that was police violence in New York or whether it was you know, segregation policies in much of the South. And because they came from different frameworks and had different life experiences, they had different messages. But the main focus that King went on was based on the fact that he had not only been raised in the church in Atlanta, but also studied Mahatma Gandhi's work and went to India after he got out of college, and felt that nonviolence was a tactic to be used, whereas Malcolm came much more from a perspective of just straight challenge and, you know, self-defense. You know, and it wasn't that there weren't any of those elements in the South also, but, you know, and many people look at them as exact opposites, or and I'm sure that the people that were concerned about the rise of this black leadership and the change that it would possibly represent and what would, you know, come to bear from it, were threatened by it and wanted to manipulate it or to eliminate it. I'm sure they saw both of them as a threat. Malcolm at one point said it would just be interesting which one they killed first, between himself and Dr. King. And where King's politics led him in the course of, because he had integrity and because he looked at the reality that was around him, he understood that it wasn't solely a question of integration and racism, it was also a question of class and poverty and a question of militarism. And so that was, I think, the first point at which they began to come to together directly, he and Malcolm, before Malcolm's death, which is 3 years before King is murdered. They had a meeting in New York, and they began to talk about working together to oppose the poverty issue and to begin to organize poor people around the country. I think had hoped to work on that, you know, and bring that to fruition even back then when Malcolm was eliminated. But even stirrings in any direction to empower black people against the racist society and the separatist and segregationist agenda were countered for a long period. Spying on the American public actually began in earnest by military intelligence and army intelligence in World War II. A Colonel Vandeman under Army G2 began collecting dossiers on radicals right after the end of World War One, his files then were given over eventually to J. Edgar Hoover. They were the basis of the Palmer raids against many immigrants and labor and left organizers in the country that got many people deported back in that period. And so those were shifted over into the control of the Federal Bureau of Investigation when that was formed. And Hoover had files eventually on, he had a quote at one point where he said, there's 250 million people in America. We have dossiers on 200 million. We have to close the gap. But some of their earliest targets were especially anybody that was moving in a politically progressive or different direction to organize within those communities of color. And so the spying on King's family actually begins with his grandfather in that early period in the 20s and 30s, even before King comes to that kind of leadership or has that agenda. Anyone that was speaking out in opposition to the system or appeared to be organizing people even in their own self-interest. Similarly, Malcolm would have been under their eye because they had been spying on very, very, very intensely and spying on Elijah Muhammad's organization since its inception, and were afraid of it. They lived in fear, of course, of the response that might come from an organized black community to these decades and decades of centuries of racism and oppression, feared an overall revolt. And so that was not only within the context of the FBI, but the CIA had memos about preventing the rise of militant or radical black leadership. They specifically talked about eliminating the possibility of a black messiah. And it's clear that Malcolm and King fit into that pattern in their minds. But CIA focused on many of the more militant and black power groups in the same period. COINTELPRO started after the end of World War II when two intelligence agents from the Navy, ONI, came over to Hoover's shop and said that they would protect his turf from the emerging CIA. And that was William Sullivan and Kartha Deek Deloach. And they formed the domestic division of the FBI, Division 5, which then began to run the counterintelligence or COINTELPRO programs to oppose the civil rights movement and not just spy on it, but to disrupt it. And dissolve it, and also to replace the leadership with people that were more acceptable. What they called a clean Negro, that they wanted to replace Dr. King. And COINTELPRO also went after the emerging Black Panther Party and the peace movement. And they weren't only surveilling, they were penetrating. They were having people go into the organizations and gather information and also cause dissension. They were looking for contradictions and fights or disagreements within the movement that existed on their own in order to increase and aggravate them and to turn people against each other, and in some cases to get people to kill each other over those differences. that's some of the context of the death of both Malcolm and Martin, but especially when Malcolm left the Nation of Islam, they were active inside the organization in promoting new leadership that was hostile to him. They were calling for his death as a traitor to the nation, and doing everything they could to exacerbate the differences and to create an assassination scenario that people would blame not on the FBI and the CIA, who were focused on them, because they also CIA was doing stuff against Malcolm and King internationally, and there were assassination attempts on Malcolm abroad as well. In one case, he was turned back from landing in Paris because of a known attempt on his life, and especially when he began to work in a pan-African direction and to make connections of African people across the globe, he became an additional threat to them, and was getting solidarity between leaders in emerging independent governments and countries that were breaking free of the old colonial rule and making connections back to home, as Dr. King eventually did, also to understand that the position of the people being killed in Vietnam in their society was very similar to the position of black and poor people here at home, and that this was not a fight that they should be involved in, and people of color shouldn't be killing other people in that same position abroad on behalf of white colonialism, because the United States took over from the French colonialists in order to stop a legitimate government that had 80% of the vote in the 50s for Ho Chi Minh, that Eisenhower admitted would happen if he had been able to run and unify the country. Instead, they blocked a vote from happening and put corrupt, bankrupt leadership into what they called South Vietnam, and they created a separate country that didn't exist, and then pretended that there was a war between North Vietnam and South Vietnam, but it was a military situation that they fostered and created themselves. And so they were able to make some of these links, and they were afraid of them, and they went into the organizations and tried to pit them as enemies against each other. To give you an idea of the perversity of this, one of the people that seems to have been fairly close to the planning of the attacks on Malcolm, if not the assassination itself, is the current leader of Nation of Islam, Farrakhan. And Farrakhan at the time sort of took Malcolm's position in the organization and was calling openly for Malcolm's head at the time. And there's some scholarship and investigation that links him to the people in the Jersey Mosque that were used as gunmen in the situation right beforehand. But news of this, of course, eventually reached Betty Shabazz and Malcolm's family, and those suspicions existed. And some years ago, when one of Malcolm's daughters, I believe she was living in Chicago, but at the time she had had a drug addiction, and so the FBI had gotten a white drug dealer to work with them and to provide drugs to her and to start a relationship with her, which included trying to see if he could get her to kill Minister Farrakhan. So, you know, they're sick enough that they'll turn around their own perversity and, you know, and have the backfire benefit them as well. And, you know, it came out that this was happening, and then the guy admitted that he was an FBI agent and had been putting her up to this and, you know, making this plot. So Chaos was the name that the CIA used for its domestic operations in this regard against the rise of black leadership and against the peace movement. And Lantern Spike was a subcategory of a broader plan called Garden Plot, which was a plan to respond to revolutionary or politically progressive movements for change by weeding the garden of the problems. That was the imagery, and it was to basically go to martial law and to have massive roundups of radicals, and they would be taken out of their communities and into mass locations or prisons, and taken without writ of habeas corpus. In the 1950s, McCarran Act was passed that allowed them in any declared emergency, and there have been many declared emergencies. We're in one now since the Truman era, starting with the Korean War. We've been in an almost constant state of declared emergency, but under that situation, they could take anybody. The language is anybody who might be thinking, might possibly be thinking of committing an act of espionage or sabotage against the United States without appearance before judge or jury or writ of habeas, and for the duration of the emergency, put them into secluded and secret internment camps. And so we see some of this, even though the McCarran Act was finally voted out, we see some of this in the response to 9/11 in terms of how they've suspended habeas corpus for these detainees and put them into categories that fall outside both constitutional law and international protocols, the Geneva Conventions about prisoners, and try to pretend that they're in some special category, which they are not. No such category exists, even under the Article 3 of Geneva, where they don't have any rights, and the rights don't have to be respected, and even to the point that if they do give them a trial, military or civilian, and they're acquitted, they still don't have to release them from the detention. So this is all extensions of the way they were starting to plan and deal with these things. They had readiness exercises for these roundups of Central American activists and others. But in the period when there was a great deal of political activity in the 1960s and early 70s, these programs became active, and they set up political assassinations with plausible explanations and stories, with patsies to take the blame. But the real movement to kill these people came from the government, and it came in response to the possibility that there would be massive social change in the militarist agenda here in the United States. Dr. King spoke in Riverside Church against the war, which isolated him from a great deal of the civil rights leadership, and there was an immediate attack on the most prominent and well-to-do civil rights leaders, saying that the two were different messages and he shouldn't be crossing the line, but he saw them as directly connected, and rightly so. And in Oslo, when he took the Nobel Peace Prize, his talk said that there were three pillars of oppression. One was the racism, one was poverty, and one was militarism. And so that was what marked his agenda, anti-war activity, and the call for a poor people's march on Washington that really still should resonate in what all that we're doing today is to have political work address all three of those. Much of what's done addresses one or the other, but few address how they interrelate, and few people have taken up King's agenda since the time that he was killed. But I think that's the context of this hostility to a rise of a black messiah or effective leadership in the black community led to a whole string of hundreds of political assassinations, not only of the nationally known leaders, but also of community leaders, and continues to this day, I believe, across the United States.
Right, definitely.
Yeah, thank you, John. This is Peter Fowler. I'm calling in from Glendale, Arizona, co-host with Solomon.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's good to have you on the show.
You
mentioned that you were in Dayton, Ohio for a little while, and we have a connection there that I finished my graduate studies in Dayton, Ohio, and worked there for a number of years. And interestingly, I went to Dayton, Ohio specifically to study with Dr. Charles Brown, who is an MLK scholar.
Mm-hmm.
And so here we are tonight. You had mentioned your work with the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Their 1979 report upheld the state's narrative of the lone gun and maintained the guilt of James Earl Ray. So let me ask you this. Based on your work, your research, do you hold that James Earl Ray shot Martin Luther King? If not, why not? And then, you know, who are the guilty parties that we need to start looking at? And then part two of that is, why do you see, why is it, help us understand why there's such a disconnect between the state's narrative, the official story, the James Earl Ray story, and the truth behind the disparate reality of Martin Luther King's death?
Well, I absolutely don't think that James Earl Ray shot Dr. King. And I think he was framed by the system to take the blame. The House Select Committee on Assassinations, although it still claimed that he was a shooter, ended up saying that both the assassinations of John F. Kennedy and King, Dr. King, were probable conspiracies. But then they closed up shop and refused to go any further and referred it to the FBI to figure out what they were. When the FBI, of course, in my view, was part of both those conspiracies and its their cover-up and their operations, so they weren't about to, you know, to reveal their own role, and they just shut it down. And they have since then tried to counter other work that points in the direction of the truth about these assassinations. I think it's important to remember that the person who was Attorney General at the time of the King assassination and who went along with the idea that there was no conspiracy immediately and announced that even before an investigation or even before Ray was caught, saying that it was a lone gunman, was Ramsey Clark. And he also presided over the Robert Kennedy assassination in a similar vein, not looking at the hard evidence that shows that there was a second gun in the pantry. King was not only being surveilled to the nth degree and by all these agencies. We have documents that we've gotten loose under FOIA and court suits that show that not only was the FBI RIBAT, which was an anti-communist program, because there was an informant in New York that was telling them that King was working for the Chinese Communist Party and under control of the communists, so they were looking at him under their anti-communism as well as COINTELPRO. The CHAOS program was looking at him for the CIA, and the Army intelligence was surveilling him very closely. And when I say closely, I mean they were going through his garbage every night in the hotel room. They knew where he was staying. They had bugs in the hotel room in advance. They was picking up everything he was talking about. They knew his travel arrangements in and out of the city. And they also compromised the security that would normally have been around him at the time of his assassination. And but all three were actively on top of him. And then in addition to that, Hoover once said that if King wielded his little toe, he knew about it, which meant that there were informants close to King and inside SCLC. One of them just recently revealed, Charles Withers, a photographer who took the iconic photographs of I Am a Man and was very close with the civil rights movement and with King, was up in the room, took the photos right afterwards of King's aides following the assassination in the room, and you know, was close with some of the people that were in the Invaders, the more militant group there in Memphis, and constantly was feeding information over those many years to the FBI about the civil rights movement. But there were others within King's circle who were making decisions about his location at the time. There was a FBI-generated letter, supposedly from a black individual in Memphis, criticizing him for staying in the white-owned motel where he often went and stayed when he was there. In response to that letter, some of his aides made arrangements for him to go to the Lorraine. Someone approached, claiming to be in King's entourage, approached Lorraine Bailey, who owned the hotel. Well, it was the wife of the person that owned the hotel, but he named it after her, and got them to move King from a room on the bottom floor up to the second floor balcony. The significance of that is if King had left the door surrounded by people and gotten into a car on the first floor, he wouldn't have been an easy shot. If you put him up on the balcony, he's got to walk along the balcony and to get to the car, and so you've got a longer time to approach hitting him. So they were moving in that direction. The security that normally would have been around him was pulled by teams within the Memphis Police Department, some of whom were former FBI themselves. The surveillance at the firehouse included military intelligence, people approaching the fire chief and getting permission to take photos from the roof of the firehouse. And Dr. William Pepper, who was a researcher, said that there's photos that veterans have seen in the military intelligence files of the actual assassin of Dr. King, not in the rooming house, but in the space behind the amusement store there,
grill.
And the hotel, the grill, Jim's Grill, in the sort of bushes behind there, and some people on the ground saw someone there as well. But security, police security that normally would have been around King was pulled out. Jesse Jackson told, supposedly at King's request, but later that was countered, told the invaders that they should leave, that King wanted them to get out of the hotel if they had arranged a room for them. And the normal security around him, they might have protected him or might have seen something coming, was actually removed from the firehouse and other places. So, and this is a common thing that you'll find in these assassinations, is a stripping of the normal forensic security that someone has. And when Dr. King was shot, there was actually only one physical witness on the balcony level to see it. There were people looking up at him from the ground. Two of them, his lawyer and his driver, said that they heard a bullet zing by their right side of their, like through their right ear. Well, they were facing King, so their right ear was away from the alleged location of James Earl Ray up in this rooming house bathroom, which was, as King was facing, upward and to his right. And so that is not consistent with a bullet coming from that direction. Joseph Lowy, because Reverend Billy Kiles drew King out, saying his wife didn't want her food to get cold. He was having dinner for him, and they came out onto the balcony, and Kiles was in the process. The others had already gone downstairs. Kiles was in the process of walking to the steps with his back to King. But an individual named Joseph Lowy, who was South African, also had his film processed at Withers' shop and may have known Withers in the intelligence context. He was a documentary filmmaker and said he was following King in order to, you know, to catch the activities of the civil rights movement. But in fact, he was also working for CIA. And the person who held King in his arms after the shooting, in that famous photograph where people are pointing upward and across the street, who had gotten back up on the balcony, but the person who got to him first and is holding him in his arms is Malcolm McCullough, who was naval intelligence and also working as a police intelligence agent with the cover of the Memphis Police Department, and later worked at CIA. And so Lowy was actually watching, though, and Lowy said that the bullet lifted Dr. King off his feet and spun him to his right. Well, a bullet coming down from the right above him would have done exactly the opposite, driven him into the balcony and to his left. I've been up in that bathroom. I went there in the early 70s. It hadn't changed at all. The tub is flush with the wall where the window is. You'd have to stand in the tub to shoot out the window. It would probably be easier to take the top window down, but neither one is easily placed to shoot through. The other problem you have is, in order to aim the rifle at the point where Dr. King would have been standing, there's a tree in the way, and there's also a wall in the way, because in order to position the rifle looking out the window, you would have to knock a hole in the wall with your left elbow in order to get the rifle over far enough to the right and the stock to be aiming at Dr. King. leaning out the window and trying to shoot would give you absolutely no purchase. And so the hard evidence to me shows that it didn't come from there. Interestingly enough, at the Civil Rights Museum, the reconstruction of the bathroom with plexiglass, similar to the phony sniper's nest in Dallas at the Sixth Floor Museum, where both these places have memorialized fake events. But when they reconstruct the bathroom, they've taken the tub and moved it several feet back from the back wall. It makes it look like you could stand behind the tub and fire out the window. But they have a photo from the time of the bathroom, which shows the tub in its actual position. So it's kind of strange that they did a reconstruction that wasn't accurate even to their own photo that they have on the wall. But it makes it easier to envision him standing there and shooting. But in fact, Ray was not in the rooming house, was not in the bathroom, and while he had under instruction bought the gun, he was hardly a gunman. The head of the firearms shop where he bought it said that the only person less knowledgeable about guns than James Earl Ray was the House Select Committee investigator who came to ask about it later. They did not do, the FBI did not do, an examination of the gun to see if it had been fired that day when they picked it up in this bundle outside of Kniep's amusement. Kniep said that he heard the shot 5 minutes after someone dropped the bundle in front of his shop. And this bundle had a prison radio that belonged to Ray, but he had left it in the prison when he escaped. And it had some underwear, I think, that Ray had taken to a laundry to get clean, but hadn't picked up yet. So it had elements in there that would link it to Ray, even though they didn't know his name at the time and weren't looking for him. They didn't even go up to the rooming house until almost an hour and a half into the scenario. The people on the balcony are pointing across the street to the bushes, and that's where the driver identified the person he saw get up out of the bushes and run the gun to the back of Jim's grill and hand it off to Lloyd Jowers, one of Lloyd Jowers' employees. Also, and a girlfriend, I think, talked about him hiding a gun for a few days until someone else came to pick it up there in Jim's grill. But this, the gun that they said in this bundle is not the actual murder weapon. And when Judge Joe Brown, who was a ballistics expert, a former Black Panther, and an elected judge in Memphis, who drew the case when James Earl Ray had his last appeal, tested the gun and found that the markings on the bullets were not consistent with the markings on the bullet taken from Dr. King's body. When he asked to see both the tests of the FBI in the 60s and the House Select Committee tests in the 70s of the same rifle and their results, he was pulled off the case for being biased by the Tennessee Supreme Court. Ray was pending appointment of a second judge for his appeal when he began to die of liver cancer from a stabbing and hepatitis C he'd gotten from a dirty knife years before in the prisons. And while they arranged a liver transplant for him, and that could have been done at Mayo Clinic, the prison refused to release him and effectively gave him a death sentence in the prison, and he died of the liver cancer before there was an additional trial. Then there was a civil trial brought by his defense attorney on behalf of the King family, who also did not believe he was the assassin. And that trial is up online, at least in part, at the King Center. The evidence in that trial not only convinced the jury that Ray was innocent, but that the high levels of the government were involved in assassinating him. But the forensics don't work. There was no formal autopsy done. Dr. Francesco, the medical examiner there, said out of respect for the family, he didn't cut into the body. So the actual direction of the shot didn't matter. The House Select Committee experts said they couldn't determine the direction of the shot or its angle, but it didn't matter because Ray did it anyway. And Ray never had a real trial. He had a mini hearing where evidence was put against him, and when he tried to speak up, he was shushed by the judge and his attorney. He said he didn't agree that there was no conspiracy in the trial, but his lawyer came to him at the last minute and said, "I didn't prepare a defense, and you better take a plea bargain and plead guilty or they're going to give you the chair." and backed him down and set him up for this phony little few-hour hearing where they just stipulated his guilt. His defense attorney stipulated that he fired the weapon that killed Dr. King, et cetera, without even investigating the weapon. So there was no real forensic link, and the gun now sits in the Civil Rights Museum, but really needs to be tested again for a final test to determine. But it is not the gun that killed Dr. King. They also had backup teams from the military intelligence and special forces up on a water tower at the railroad building who had King in their sights, had not the setup team been able to carry out the shot. What you do is you have a patsy and backups who can be linked to other elements, racism or the mob or whatever you need, in order to create the cover story. But the real gunmen are often professionals, from somewhere else. And Jowers said in the civil trial that he was given money to hire a gunman and got a police weapons expert who's now passed on to fire the shot. Regardless of who did the shooting, the person I suspect is named Jack Youngblood. The landlady was asked about who rented the room, and she gave a witness description that led to a police drawing of the suspect, and it does not look at all like James O. Ray. It's probably the person that Ray knew as Raul, who I think is Youngblood. It matches one of the three tramps in Dealey Plaza who were arrested at the time in a boxcar. It looks exactly like that person, and that picture also matches Youngblood's photo in the back of his book. He was Naval Intelligence. He was part of the Bay of Pigs operation, and he's a professional killer. But regardless of who fired the shot, it was not Ray, and Ray was tracked down then eventually as the assassin, but didn't do it. And eventually history bore out his innocence, although many people don't know it because nobody covered that trial, trial of the century down in Memphis, and most of the public are still hear the false investigation and the cover-up. But the point is to be able to kill someone with impunity and, if necessary, to blame or even engage other groups that want the person dead. At the time they can take the credit, later they can take the blame, but the hand behind them is not going to be seen.
Right. I'm glad you put that in perspective. And so a couple more questions, John. And, folks that are listening, that was really important that John put that in perspective because, when we celebrate his life every single year, as we do, and a lot of the times, yes, it's out of context, especially within the corporate media, you have these Democrats and Republicans alike. You have, recently the one of the attorneys for the Pentagon, basically saying that if Dr. King were alive today, he would probably understand and support the need for this occupation and war in Afghanistan. But when we celebrate his life every single year and often out of context, with this cold case, and it is a cold case, despite what you might see and hear on the media. I was watching a program today hosted by Tom Brokaw on the History Channel, and they had this stooge, this so-called historian there, saying that, without a doubt, I know that James Earl Ray was was and had to be the lone gunman, but, which is a total farce. We cannot celebrate his birthday until his death is and forget his death, and therefore his the case surrounding his death must be solved because justice delayed is justice denied. And that leads me to my question, John, my final question, and then Peter has his final question coming up. My question is, where do we stand right now? Right, because we know this is a cold case. Where do we stand right now regarding the bill that was introduced, the act that was introduced by Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Records Act, the 107th and 109th Congress, and because we know that despite the fact that even looking at the 110th Congress, we see the silence of so-called civil rights leadership on the release of these files, and we know that even though these files have not been released and they continue to be held in abeyance, we know that National Declassification Center, there can be a review through there, and we know that Obama, through executive order, could open up these files. Where do we stand regarding all that? And you know, John Kerry and John Lewis and their whole role that they played in this. You know, where do we stand with all that regarding this case and the files?
Well, I had worked with people to get the files loose since the 90s on these political assassinations. We eventually helped to get the Committee for an Open Archives that I was part of some bills drafted, but that never got to the floor to release the House Select Committee files. And then I worked in 2001 with Cynthia McKinney, not on staff, but just on this issue. She was very concerned about it and about COINTELPRO and wanted to get the records loose. And so I drafted a bill for her at that point, working with her staff, that was modeled on the JFK Records Act. This was much better than the Freedom of Information Act, which only got a few thousand pages out over many years on his assassination. This released all state, local, federal records, court records, international records, and called for full release and presumption of release, and was decided by an independent panel, not by the agencies. And while it had certain flaws to it, it's already released over 6.5 million pages on the Kennedy assassination. So we patterned a Martin Luther King Records Act on that bill. She introduced it on the way out on the 107th. It didn't go anywhere. When I worked for her in the 109th Congress, we introduced it again. It had 67 co-sponsors in the House. It was sponsored by both John Kerry and Hillary Clinton on the Senate side. But at the last moment, it got some opposition right after Coretta Scott King died by some of the children who were concerned about what might be dirt that might be in the files against Dr. King. And we tried to make some last-minute changes that would give the children, you know, a role in the advisory level of the releases, and I'm sure that sort of stuff, it had to come up. They'd been given a chance, as the Kennedys recently were, in the release of some files about their family to review and at least recommend. We weren't looking for the dirt of FBI informants on Dr. King, whose reliability is next to nil anyway. The dirt in those records is mostly dirt on the government, and but it kept us from getting the bill introduced in that Congress. Then there was, at the time of King's birthday in the 110th Congress, over a year ago now, John Kerry in the Senate and John Lewis in the Congress said that they were going to reintroduce the same bill. And we went to, we had been going before that to a number of the committees in Congress, especially on the House side, that deal with Freedom of Information Act and release of files, trying to get them to support a version of the bill. The civil rights leadership is either silent on much of this, although we had support from certain members for the McKinney bill, and I think in part it's because these files may, as did the release of the files concerning Withers, reveal informants, within that leadership history. But for whatever reasons, we've been sort of the sole organization focused on getting these files loose, from the government for many years. So that bill started and then sort of died a morning, and both Kerry's staff and Lewis's staff put it on back burners. We encouraged them to get in touch with the family and work out any problems they had with it. there are some other options for release. One thing that was suggested was to expedite the House Select Committee timeline. It was on a 50-year lockup by Congress. People don't realize that both Congress and the executive lock up records. It's not always the executive branch and the president that locks things up in the agencies. It's also the Congress when they do an investigation. So that was locked up for 50 years from 78 until 2028. And so one proposal was a bill that would just speed that timeline up and get at least those 600,000 to 700,000 pages released. Nothing's been moved on it, but we would rather have the King Files Act include grand jury records, court records, local and state records, even though we know some of those have been destroyed, and as well as all the federal agency records and international records about Dr. King, and it covers his life and his death. The National Declassification Center can do a review, and Obama put out an executive order right when he came in office that released all files that were more than 25 years old without a review. And this declassification center was set up to do that, but they only have about 6 employees. And I went to a public meeting where they're asking what the priorities should be. And we said that these congressionally investigated matters should be like the King assassination and Kennedy assassination first and COINTELPRO and Watergate, Contragate, and these things that had enough public interest that Congress looked at them. So right now it's pending. We don't have a cold case investigation. The problem with putting it into the cold case category is that those records would not then be released to the public. They'd be held by the prosecutors or whoever was working. So it would delay their release even further, and I think possibly the public response is better.
Thanks, John. Unfortunately, due to time constraints, this is going to have to be our last question. Let me say this just ahead of time. You have been a wealth of information thus far, and I greatly appreciate all your insights. My last question, even though I could have this conversation with you all night long, you mentioned the military backup teams, the assassination teams that were in place to ensure that King was killed that particular day.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Who in the federal government, whether it's individual names or just positions in the government, would have been in position to orchestrate such a complex setup, the kind that you implicated in terms of something that would have had to include the Memphis Police Department, the Tennessee State Police, local, regional, federal operatives, and not just so that we can better understand the truth behind the events of and leading up to April 4th, 1968, but in the broader context of the socio-political climate in the United States in the 60s as well as in the 21st century.
Well, I think that the way to understand this is not that somebody would just cold try to go out and recruit a bunch of people in a city police department to go along with some national conspiracy. I think what will make sense of it, if you think about it, is that the police departments are often made up of military veterans, and people that come out of a military experience are often made up of people that come out from the FBI as well. And there's crossover between all of these intelligence agencies and the police agencies. Now we've got fusion groups and what they call joint task forces that openly interrelate these things. But if you look closely, you'll find that almost all the police departments that are involved here, like in New York, there was BOSS, Bureau of Special Services, and that was a special intelligence unit within that police department, and they had special intelligence units that were focused on countering activism. And those were often made up of people who had intelligence backgrounds from the agencies or had military backgrounds. A lot of the police in Dallas, I think 30 out of 50 in the unit that was required to guard Kennedy were part of, at the same time, a military intelligence reserve unit in Dallas. And these were also units that were interlinked with the planning for martial law, the planning for continuity of government. And so it's really a whole compromising of local police over a long period of time, and the militarization of police essentially from the Vietnam period forward, that sets the framework for many of these things happening. But I don't see them as seamless, elements that then you have to go, you know, you have to go and penetrate like these separate groups or enlist people. They're already your people. It's a matter of you've got the network in place and you use it. And for people who want to read about the assassination, I think some of the best books are Dr. William Pepper's Orders to Kill and Acts of State, and he has a third one coming out. T. Carter has done research with Ray's brother, and she has a book coming out this year called A Memoir of Injustice, based on what happened to the family and what Ray knew. Jim Douglas is working on a book on both King and Malcolm's assassination. His book on Kennedy is JFK and the Unthinkable. There were also researchers into the Kennedy assassination that crossed over early on and looked at the King assassination. Harold Weisberg was one. Frame Up, Dick Gregory and Mark Lane worked on a book called Codename Zorro. Phil Melanson did extensive work on both King and Kennedy assassinations. And Dr. Claiborne Carson is the head of the King family papers, but he did a book about the FBI looking at Dr. King and the papers on him. So there have been investigators over the years that have looked at this. Conspiracies, The Unraveling of the Assassination of Malcolm X by Babazak Kondo, names the actual assassins and lays out the FBI's role in the case. And Carl Evans did another book called The Judas Factor that's good on Malcolm's killing. So there are books out there where you can find some of this history that I'm talking about, but we really would do better to get the full files loose, and then we would see who was who in these operations. But I think that we think about conspiracies like who would be in a position. Well, it's an interrelated system that's been working against a democratic rule in this society for many, many years and establishing its power, and it has agents that penetrate all the different levels of the court system, the police system, as well as the intelligence agencies and the investigative system. A friend of mine used to say, if you want to commit the perfect crime, control the investigation.
That's good, yeah. Thank you so much, John. I appreciate that. Before we go, can you let our listeners know, you have a website, and can you give them the address? You mentioned COPA before. And
yes, Coalition on Political Assassinations has a site. It's just www.politicalassassinations, that's with an S, plural, politicalassassinations.com. And that's got a lot of these materials and speakers from our recent conferences and ongoing things that we post about the assassinations.
What about it? Do you have an email that if people are
listening COPA,
right now,
COPA,
want to get in contact with you?
Yeah, it's COPA at starpower, starpower.net. And people are interested can write there, and we can be in touch.
Definitely.
Thank you for the time and having me on.
Thank you. On behalf of Your World News, thank you so much, John. We look forward. This is not your first time on. You know, you've been on before, talking about similar things. And I remember when Cynthia McKinney was held captive by the Israeli government. You came on and provided great insight to what was going on. And since you were very close to the vest with that situation, so we look forward to having you on. Talking about different subjects as well.
Yes, there were assassination attempts against Cynthia and threats similar to this situation with Gabrielle Giffords at the time from the far right wing. It's been forgotten, but people calling for her to be lynched. And we can't ask young black men to follow in the footsteps of Malcolm or Martin if we don't solve their assassinations.
Right. And real quick, before you go, could you tell us what, because, we've had this conversation. Can you tell us what research that you have unfolded regarding Gabby Giffords' assassination attempt, just like a couple weeks ago?
Well, just quickly, I mean, she definitely had been targeted at the national level for removal from office by political leadership. You know, there were elements of this right-wing Tea Party and the other right-wing commentators and the agenda, as well as the political elements of the political establishment on the Republican side, that wanted her removed from office. This individual may be someone who acted on his own, was, you know, slightly demented, but he didn't do it in a vacuum, and he didn't get the ideas of who to attack in a vacuum. He was clearly trying to make himself a hero to people on websites that he followed that were white supremacist and reactionary, and who saw her as an enemy to be removed. The framework for her was demonstrations right up to the time of her death outside her door with the lock and load theme, with the idea of, you know, removing her by any means possible. And all of this has just been an ongoing escalation of right-wing and violent rhetoric and political posturing and fight promotion since the end of the Fairness Doctrine under the Reagan period. And people are being targeted out. And then she's in a state, of course, where, you know, you can carry a concealed weapon, and where even Obama was approached by people with guns. So, but I think, you know, it ought to give us some pause. I mean, because I don't think this is the beginning or the end of these kind of attacks. Many people don't know that, you know, there have been dozens of these kind of attacks on judges and on political people that aren't responded to. They may be more now so when the threats are made. Cynthia McKinney had a neo-Nazi say that she should be strung up and lynched on her way to the polls, and he was going to talk about that on his radio show. And we called the FBI in New Jersey. They said, oh, we know about Mr. Hal Turner. We know all about him. Well, it turns out, at least in his own defense, he says that he was an FBI informant and that they were giving him the things to say in order to bring other people out of the woodwork. FBI won't confirm or deny, but it's interesting that that was his defense. In that case, yes, they certainly did know all about him. But they didn't lift a finger to do anything to protect Cynthia at the time that, you know, her life was threatened.
Right, and we know that that when that couple walked into that White House party, we know that that was a message that was being sent to Obama.
I believe it was. I mean, they were invited by Richard Gates' secretary and Secretary of Defense, and he, you know, he they get in there. The Secret Service doesn't show up. They're not vetting people. They try to blame the social secretary, but if you can get someone into a room next to you, they can kill you. They don't have to have a gun on them. I believe it was a message both to Obama and to the Indian ambassador, who was balking somewhat at our policies in relation to Afghanistan and Pakistan and the oil deals at the time, and was leaning toward making deals with Iran about oil instead of going with our pipelines. I think it was a message to both of them that they, you know, they weren't particularly safe. And then Gates, on his way back from the meeting in Pakistan, said, it was quoted in the New York Times saying that he relaxed on the 14-hour trip home by watching the film 7 Days in May about a military coup in the United States. And I think that that's a thinly veiled message to the Obama administration that, you know, they can always be removed.
Right.
In the same way that the Joint Chiefs removed John F. Kennedy in 1963 in a military coup.
Exactly. And we saw, you know, same thing happen with Clinton, with the Puerto Rican nationals and the plane that was, you know, was it either flown into the old executive building or near?
Yeah. They had a guy fly a plane into the back of the White House, and, you know, they said the Clintons weren't in any danger. They were in another location up the street, and they gave the location. Well, if you don't know who the guy is flying the plane, or if he has any associates, how can you immediately be giving out, you know, the next place that you missed him and he's over here? And then, ironically, that they came out and stated that Clinton said they weren't going to change their plans that day, and that they were going to continue with their plans to go to the Ford Theater where Lincoln was assassinated that evening.
Right.
So they get their messages and they make their threats, but sometimes, you know, loose cannon carry them out, or other times programmed assassins carry them out. There's not too much in this guy's background. He seemed to live at home. He doesn't seem to have any. He tried to join the military and was turned down. He doesn't seem to have a background or even psychiatric care that would allow them to do any programming. But in many of the other cases, the patsies are programmed. And I am looking at the doctors who came in later and looked at Gifford's charts and x-rays and said that she was shot from the front to the back of her head, when the original doctors had decided that she was shot from the back to the front. Usually that's fairly easy to tell because it's pushing brain matter and there's different kind of beveling. But it would be interesting then to get eyewitnesses about where exactly was this young man, Loeffner, located in relation to her. Because that's the same question of the Kennedy assassination, and actually in the Robert Kennedy assassination too, is what direction was the bullet going and where was the gunman? And so if he was behind her at the time, and it was in fact a front-to-back shot, then you've got a second gun, which there well could have been, to make sure that both she's dead and that the person that they want blamed is, you know, seen as the gunman.
Right.
That's the Senator Reagan assassination was like that. But we could spend another night on this, and I don't want to take your time.
Exactly. Well, we'll have you on again, and that's for sure. This is not corporate media, so we'll have you on again, unfettered and raw. So thanks again.
All right.
Yeah, thank you, John.
Thank you. Thanks, Peter.
That was John Judge, and we'll deconstruct that a little bit and move forward. On the other end of this break, I'm going to play this clip by Glenn Ford, which I think will set the table for the remainder of the dialogue. I see we have a couple of callers online, which is good. And so I think this clip right now by Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Report will really set the table for the rest of the evening's dialogue. And I really hope that folks, you contact John Judge. Once again, it's COPA, C-O-P-A, at starpower.net. That's C-O-P-A at starpower.net. You know, reach out to him. There's a wealth of information. And the best thing about his talks is that he will give you the references, the documents, the articles in which he's extracted this information. So here's Glenn Ford with something that he just did recently, you know, simply called, "What Would MLK Do?"
What would Dr. King do? It's that time of year, and always a good time to ask that question. We can begin to answer it by saying what the Martin Luther King Jr., who was assassinated on April 4, 1968, would not be doing. He would not be erecting a protective barrier around Barack Obama, the first black president of the United States, but would instead confront him. He would not shrink from denouncing and opposing Obama's wars. Dr. King would never passively tolerate the wholesale consumption of the American state by Wall Street. He would not have stood by for four decades while the United States created a system of mass black incarceration that has now been dubbed the new Jim Crow. And we know he would have found it impossible to sit still while George Bush and then Barack Obama turned public education into a stifling exercise in learning for the test. Why are we so confident about how Dr. King would respond to contemporary crises if he were alive today? Because King left a great bounty of documentation, enough writing, speeches, papers, and interviews to make Confucius envious. Therefore, we have every reason to believe that Dr. King would vigorously oppose President Obama's war budgets, the biggest in American history. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift, said Dr. King, is approaching spiritual doom. But King was concerned about bread and butter issues as well. One of the greatest casualties of war in Vietnam is the Great Society, which the Southern Christian Leadership Conference leader said was shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam. Dr. King would have been unceasing in his opposition to mass black incarceration. In early 1968, King declared, "It is incontestable and deplorable that Negroes have committed crimes, but they are derivative crimes. They are born of the greater crimes of the white society." He would have been moved to action by the U.S. Supreme Court's decision allowing corporations to be treated as having the same rights as persons. "Property," said Dr. King, "is intended to serve life, and no matter how much we surround it with rights and respect, it has no personal being. It is part of the earth man walks on. It is not man. Plus, we know MLK was a democratic socialist because he said so." Dr. King, the intellectual, the philosopher, made himself clear on the value and uses of education back in 1947 when he was a student at Morehouse College in Atlanta. "The function of education," said the very young man, "is to teach one to think intensely and to think critically. Intelligence plus character, that is the goal of true education." It is inconceivable that King would have permitted No Child Left Behind and its destructive derivatives to wreck the learning experiences of the nation's children without a fight. Dr. King would actively oppose Barack Obama's policies because, as he said, "He who passively accepts evil is as much involved in it as he who helps to perpetrate it. He who accepts evil without protesting against it is really cooperating with it." For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
That was Glenn Ford. We say it all the time, if you've never been to blackagendareport.com, make sure you frequent that website on a daily basis. They upload a lot of information each Wednesday, but they even upload information onto their site, between Wednesday to Wednesday. But I see we have a caller on the line, Peter. I want to put them through. They've been really patient, and I don't know if they're just listening through on the phone line or if they have some questions or comments. So, caller, you are on the line right now. And I don't know if you're calling from the Virgin Islands, but the area code seems to be such.
Yes,
can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. Oh, greetings. I'm from Trinidad myself.
Okay, good. I've been listening to, the talk show involving Dr. King, but what I want to say is that there's the other side of Dr. King that the public don't know about. Most of us are tend to believe, based on the media, that King was an integrationist. But there are five books that he has written, authored himself, and these five books are never seen, and much people don't know about those. And these books basically talk about issues pertaining to the black community and about empowerment and black owning business and controlling the political, part of their business. But anyways, I must say that, after I have studied the man and basically know about him from doing a lot of reading that you would not see in mainstream, I have come to understand him better and could appreciate him a lot more. So we all need to, do our own research and stuff. In light of the fact we have the internet and we have a lot of other resources that was not available, before. So I do think that your show raised a lot of critical issues in terms of the role of the government and stuff that's still happening to us this day. So, to summarize it, not much has changed. We're still in the same predicament or even worse. As you pointed out, a lot of our people are going off to the prison complex, which is the next billion-dollar business.
Right, and you're calling from the U.S. Virgin Islands?
Yes, from St. Thomas.
Okay, which can be also regarded as a colony of the U.S.
You know, they have been a lot of people been raising the issue about self-determination, and the United States have always denied the people that opportunity. So here is an unincorporated territory, and a lot of people have taken the issue to the Supreme Court about the status, and the Supreme Court have always ruled that the Constitution does not follow the flag. So, you know, we basically are able to go after war to fight for democracy in other people's country, but right here we don't get no justice.
Right. You're exactly right. You're exactly right. Before you get off the line, Peter and I would like to know what's one of the things that you're most impressed about what Dr. King stood for?
Well, you know, he basically stood for, you know, for us to basically, you know, be more progressive and be more responsible and, like I say, control the business and stuff within our community. So they, like here in the Virgin Islands, although it's predominantly black, you find that whatever, you know, businesses they are, what the whites don't have or don't want is the Arabs. So our own government has allowed the monies of the government retirement system, instead of being invested here, look at the other day, they just gave this company named Diageo, which is a $1 billion company, they gave it $250 million of the taxpayer money and gave them land for free. And then the money that we also get back to go in the coffers, which is called the rum cover over, they gave them 50% of that. You see what I'm saying? So these people started a war with Puerto Rico because Puerto Rico is saying, well, you know, this system was set up by the government, by Congress, so y'all could make money, but y'all giving the shop away. So right now, Charles Rangel, he was part of that deal where they made all this money under the table by selling out the people of the Virgin Islands. So I'm sure some kind of investigation is going to be coming up on that. So if you thought he'd get away with that mild heart attack that he had, you have a bigger one coming. So there's a lot of crooked book now, you know. It's the rape of the Virgin Islands all over again. Everything that you know we had was given away. And the other second thing to note is that when the Danish used to own this place and the black people them had fought for, you know, their sovereignty, the Danish still sold it to the United States in 1917 for a sum of $25 million. So the people here had no say. Then it was placed under naval rule. So the Navy was in charge of the islands from 1917 till 1931. And the Navy was very, very racist. They used to treat blacks here just like down south, rape the women, do all sort of things. And then people all cry to the U.S. government, then they turn it over to the Department of Interior. So it's still under the Department of Interior from that time till now. So the people in Puerto Rico say when the Puerto Rico governor goes to Washington, he goes to the White House. When the Virgin Islands governor goes to Washington, he goes to the office in the Department of Interior. So you see the difference?
Yes. Yeah.
So
change. Nothing.
So
I'm really And just the fact that I'm glad you brought that up because that has so much to do with Dr. King and looking at Americanism now because you know you're right, nothing has changed. America still is this imperialist nation that has these neo colonies and just the fact that you had the Danish sell, you know what I'm saying? I mean the fact that they sold like you know what I'm saying, they sold land that was not yours. They you know, and that's been the MO
was not theirs because they had nothing to sell because the people had already fought for the freedom and was a sovereign country. But then, you know, they sold it to the United States. Then the people here had no nationality for 10 years. The United States pondered whether they're going to give them citizenship or not give them citizenship, you know. And up until, like the war was, you know, we was not eligible to be drafted or nothing, but there was some Uncle Tom Negroes here who cried and said, we want to be good American citizens, so please let us go into war and all of that, you know. So we cannot vote for represent the United States, but we can go off and die in this and that. And then those people come over here and have more rights than us, like the Arabs. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, without a doubt, man.
So that's the thing.
No, I was just saying, and you have all those corporations there, and the people that benefit the least in the Virgin Islands, as they do in Jamaica, from the tourism, is the people themselves. You know, the profiteers are these large corporations that go right back into the coffers of these, you know, bigwig U.S. elites, you know, because these beaches are basically, you know, bought and sold, and you know, you have everything from sandals to Carnival Cruise Lines just infiltrating, you know, throughout the Caribbean. And so people that can't control their own land, you know, they can't be considered free. You know, they might try to
Look at what happened. Okay, look, for example, Hess Oil refineries, which came in the 60s. Hess Oil got everything for free. Everything. And they have destroyed the aquifer of St. Croix, kill off almost all the reefs and the fish where those tankers comes in. St. Croix have the highest cancer rate under the U.S. flag because of the oil refinery. And up to now, the EPA cannot tell the people what's going on. They just kept a party for the governor of the Virgin Islands the other day. And the governor nor the health department are nothing. Every day they put this toxic emission into the air where the school close to the refinery have to close. People are choking. They have to go to the hospital and pay their own bill. You know, and these people get billions of dollars in tax break. And right here, where the refinery is, we pay more for gasoline than up in New York or any place in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, you know,
right. Nobody
wants to stand up for them. And you know what? Hess is the biggest supplier of fuel to the U.S. military. So you could clearly see why.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, can't control their own destiny. And I hope that people are listening to this right now, and whether they're listening live or on archive, you bring this conversation up with your friends, because this is something that's common that they don't, you know, when you see these fancy commercials about, you know, going to the Bahamas, going to the Virgin Islands, going to Jamaica, you don't see this. And there's a great documentary online that if you go to Google Video called Life in Debt. Life in Debt, DEBT, which shows the role that this kind of thing has played in Jamaica. But, you know, this has been what you see in that documentary, you know, is replicated in several different islands throughout the Caribbean. And this is something that, if you're on the side of justice, this is something that we have to raise, those of us that live within the United States of America, that we have to raise. We can't continue to allow our tax dollars to support this kind of thing. This is a real serious thing. I'm from the Caribbean myself, you know, from Trinidad. It's a little bit of a different story, but I know, you know, what goes on with our brothers and sisters in places like Bermuda and Jamaica and definitely the U.S. Virgin Islands. So, I really appreciate you you calling in, and please stay in touch with the show, because perhaps down the line we'd like to do a show on this.
Yeah, well, it's a lot of issues because look at that. Like I told you, Hess Oil and St. Croix, because of the emission that the EPA or the government is doing nothing about, St. Croix have the highest cancer rate under the U.S. flag, the highest cancer rate because of that refinery. Now, on the British island of Tortola, they have a little incinerator. And, you know, the plant that they use to burn the garbage meets U.S. specs, but the whites living on the eastern end of St. John makes a lot of noise for the EPA. The EPA put monitor up there to test the emission that's coming from that thing that they use to burn it, the incinerator and Tortola. And although the EPA say, well, their finding shows that it's minimal, the whites pressure them so much that they say they're going to bring some new ones in. Now on St. Croix, where Hess is putting this dark cloud over St. Croix every day, there's no monitoring. Nothing. Up to now, the EPA can't tell the people what's going on for years now. But they went off a handful of white people say, oh, those people in Tortola is killing us with the smoke. There's no smoke. They went to Tortola with a delegation to petition the British government over there. And they say, well, listen, you guys have more problem in St. Croix than this. Why you are coming over here talking about an incinerator besides the meat you expect? And that was the end of the meeting. The majority of the black people here can't get no justice. And Hess is killing the people in St. Croix, destroying the aquifer, destroying everything. And there's nobody saying nothing to Hess Oil.
Yeah, right. I want to put this out there. I'm going to, you know, give you my my email address, our email address right now, brother, because we'd like to do a show on the Caribbean, you know, Haiti and beyond, you know, Jamaica, U.S. Virgin Islands. And I'd love for you to be, you know, one of our guests on that show. So my our email is yourworldnews2010 at gmail.com. So it's, yeah, yourworldnews2010 at gmail.com.
Okay.
Please email me after the show. And, you know, we'd like to set something up in the very, very near future to do a show, an expanded show on this, about the day-to-day lives, looking at the day-to-day lives of black people within U.S. Virgin Islands, you know, and how much or how little they benefit from these U.S. corporations and tourism on their own soil that, as you rightfully said, you know, became liberated on, you know. So thank you for calling in.
Yeah, man. Okay, you take care.
Thank you, bro.
Take care.
Yeah, that's really something near and dear to me, as you know, Peter.
Right.
You know, myself being from the Caribbean, you know, it's but Peter, you know, to you know, I'd like to get your thoughts on expounding on Glenn Ford's piece just now, and you know, I think John Judge, there's very little we can expound upon that. I think he did a really good job in terms of painting a really broad scope on the U.S. government's role in the assassination of not just King, but Malcolm and so many others. And the ones that we hear of, I'm glad John brought that up, the ones that we hear of are just the tip of the iceberg. There are so many political assassinations, literally hundreds, that have gone on over the decades of political activists that are only well known in their local communities, you know, and these are political assassinations that have occurred by and large by the alphabet cops, CIA, FBI, DIA, and the like, and pretty much get no, these individuals get no pub, you know, but those in the local communities know very well about them. And, you know, and you know, there's, you know, Gare Webb, you know, expounded on a lot of this kind of similar stuff regarding the influx of cocaine, the legal entrance of cocaine into the U.S. and Dark Alliance, which was a magnificently well put together, well researched book. But these kind of political assassinations have don't fool yourself, folks. It hasn't just been King and X and both the Kennedys. There's been many, 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 many more people who are local activists on smaller levels who have been, as they say, eliminated. So, Peter, I know what your thought. I'd like to get your thoughts on just looking at Dr. King and his legacy in 2011. 700 plus military bases, 700 to 1,000 military bases, Peter. $1 trillion. And Peter, I'll leave this softball for you. I'm going to read this quote, and then, Peter, I want to get your thoughts. Dr. King said in March of 68, he said, America gave the black man actually, you know what, that's not even the one I want. This one is a good one. America gave the black man a bad check that's been bouncing all around. You are even unjustly spending $500,000 to kill a single Viet Cong soldier, while you spend only $53 a year per person for everybody categorized as poverty-stricken, instead of spending $35 billion every year to fight an unjust war in Vietnam and $20 billion to put a man on the moon. We need to put God's children on their own two feet. And that's very, very telling, Peter. I'll let you take it, because you know that we're spending much, much more than that right now on military expenditure and on destruction. Every 2 days,
the U.S. is spending $1 billion in Afghanistan on that illegal occupation.
Right. You know, there's several threads going through our current conversation right now. So let me try to tie some of those up. Just concluding with John Judge's interview, you know, just a wealth of information, and I hope our listeners were taking notes, and also particularly on some of the resources that he mentioned at the end of his time with us, some of those books and authors and so forth, and to follow up for yourself, okay, on the picture that John Judge just painted for us in terms of the assassination, the government's involvement at various levels, and what that means, not just for King's death, but what that means for us today. So please do that. And also, for listeners, feel free to email either one of us for follow up on what John Judge was talking about. But at any rate, one of the things John mentioned was a historical note about the Weimar Republic. All right. It's interesting that he started off his remarks with a reference to the Weimar Republic, which was the German government prior to the ascension of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party. And he mentioned that there was over 400 political assassinations in the Weimar Republic leading up to the Nazi takeover of that government. And it's interesting to note that after World War II, the surveillance and other spying techniques of the United States government, particularly on progressive groups and black liberation groups, was ratcheted up tenfold or a hundredfold even. And it's common knowledge that the United States government brought into the fold former, you know, Nazi operatives, former German officials. And so, you know, we can see that they were learning from the Weimar Republic, from Nazi Germany, in terms of how to crush dissent, internal dissent, domestic dissent. Now, you know, we don't have the same kind of insight or information on what was going on in the Weimar Republic, because that's one of the techniques that the United States government has developed to an art, is how to keep that stuff quiet, how to keep it behind behind curtains. And the MLK assassination is just a case in point, a definitive example of how a political assassination is painted to be something else. All right, the lone gunman theory in the official narrative, you know, and that goes back to both John and Bobby Kennedy, Malcolm X, and so many other people. And we see why the black liberation movements that grew out of the civil rights movements were infiltrated and eventually annihilated through, you know, COINTELPRO and the mass incarceration, harassment, murder of black liberation fighters. And so, you know, there's these connections here historically. And you know, in terms of you know, other connections, the quote that you read from King is particularly important, because that notion of America give the black man a bad check is something that we don't hear coming off the lips of Martin Luther King, because of the apparatus that controls what we do hear coming off the lips of Martin Luther King. But you know he said that. That's what he started with, the speech that has become known as the I Have a Dream speech. He did not give that speech the title I Have a Dream. That was a motif that he had used on a number of occasions prior to the March on Washington, and that was a rhetorical flourish that he used after he went away from his notes during that particular speech. And what he started off the speech was America has given us a bad check. All right, and so that is a theme that King was focusing on in the later years of his life, was that bad check that America has not lived up to its ideals, particularly in relation to the black community. Now, let me tie that into something that Glenn Ford said in that clip that we heard. He said, you know, this time of year we hear a lot of folks talking about what would Martin Luther King do in the face of the crises that we face today as a country. And then Ford kind of turned around and said, what would King not do? Well, King would not be ignoring the crises in the black community the way that our black president is and has been for the last 2 years. You know, something that Glenn Ford has talked about before, and we've heard it on the show about how he just continues to ignore the crises in the black community and has so much as said, you know, there's really no crisis in the black community. We have crises in America. Well, King did not do that. You know, King did not ignore the plight of black America. King was focused on the plight of black America. And then only later did he incorporate the plight of poor folks and other exploited and oppressed people who were not of color or not of African American descent. But his primary focus was on African Americans and the plight of black Americans. And so that bad check to black America is something that we need to keep in front of us when we think about Dr. King. And another thing about Dr. King that our caller, the brother who called in just now from the Virgin Isles, pointed out as he was talking about some of the issues in the Caribbean, is that Dr. King was very much an internationalist. Dr. King was very much an internationalist. He started off, obviously, in Montgomery, Alabama, with the bus system there and the Montgomery Improvement Association. But we see just several years later, he's getting the Nobel Peace Prize for, you know, his efforts nationwide, and then his efforts globally. At the end of his life, he's speaking out against global oppression, and he's speaking out on behalf of the Vietnamese people. And so we see a very different Dr. King than the one that the media and the apparatus wants to give us, this anesthetized caricature of Dr. King as a meek and mild pacifist who just wanted black and white folks, you know, to get along together and live side by side. And also our caller, you know, mentioned that, you know, the misinterpretation of King as an integrationist. Yeah, King did fight for integration, but that wasn't the end. You know, when King, unfortunately, King was assassinated, so, you know, he couldn't build on integration. Integration was a means, not an end. You know, Martin Luther King didn't die so that we could have integrated neighborhoods. Now, that wasn't the point. That was King believed that integration would be reflective of deeper changes that were necessary, what he called the revolution of values and restructuring, fundamentally restructuring American society. So, no, King was not an integrationist per se. That's not what he was fighting for. That's not what he died for. He was very much an internationalist, and he did, especially in that last year of his life, very, very seriously and radically critique the military industrial complex that, I mean, at that point, the late 60s, was really in a fledgling state compared to what it is now, this Leviathan in military industrial complex that we have in 2011. Dr. King would be speaking out about it every day. There's no question about that. You know, he would not be ignoring the mass militarization of society. He would not be ignoring the mass incarceration of black Americans. Mm-hmm. You know, Dr. King would be fighting at every opportunity against militarization, against militarism, against racism, and all the ways that those evil triplets are manifest today. The way Glenn Ford says, you know, that's really, you know, white supremacy and American imperialism today. That's the kind of the language that we can use today to articulate what Dr. King was talking about in the 1960s. So we need to understand that Dr. King was much more radical than the Dr. King that we, you know, hear about once a year in January around the holiday. But he was much more radical. And like Glenn said, and a lot of people don't want to hear this, MLK was a democratic socialist. Yeah, I said it. He was a socialist. Now, you know, he was influenced by a lot of people who were very radical for the 1960s, you know, including Malcolm X. You know, Martin and Malcolm were a lot closer philosophically than we like to give them credit for. And I like to think that had both of them lived, they would have been working side by side on the same platform for black liberation struggles in the 1970s if they had both lived that far, which is why, Solomon, as you know, the apparatus had to take them out. Could not allow them to see the 1970s because they would have been much too dangerous if they had been allowed to live and were able to work together and join forces. Much too dangerous. to the white supremacist structure of the United States. You know, so he was influenced by Malcolm X. He was influenced by Bayard Rustin. He was influenced by A. Philip Randolph and unionism. So we see over his lifetime and over his career a radicalization philosophically, strategically, and ethically throughout the later years of his life. Those are the things that we need to be mindful of and to emphasize, rather than just this caricature, the Santa Clausification of Dr. King that gets trotted out once a year around his holiday. So those are some of the threads that we have exposed just tonight, and that we need to make plain in terms of the importance of Dr. King as a historical personage, as well as the importance of Dr. King's ethics and philosophy and strategies for liberation, and what they mean for us now in the 21st century.
Yeah, definitely, and you know, folks, you know, interesting enough, the next speech that we know from historical record, from letters that he sent to his father, the next speech that he was going to deliver, had he not been eliminated by the apparatus, you know, was entitled "Why America May Go to Hell." Why
right.
America may go to hell. That was the title, and we can only imagine, you know, what that speech in terms of content would have delivered. But that was the title of his very next speech: "Why America may go to hell." If you don't believe me, just go into Google and type that in. But that's historical record released from letter sent to his father. And folks in his inner circle, you know, have disclosed that was the title of his very next speech. And I want to play this really quickly. This is, you know, Dr. King, you know, because, you know, we're going to, you know, obviously during February we're going to, you know, do stuff on Black History Month, but it doesn't start and stop with that month. It's Black History Lifetime, as we mentioned last year, February 2010. That these things are going to go on throughout. And so in that same vein, you know, we can look at the work of Martin and Malcolm, Kwame Ture, otherwise known as Stokely Carmichael, Ida B. Wells, Daniel Lehmer, their work, and, you know, Claudia Jones, you know, Paul Robeson, their work, the life and legacy of these individuals, you know, throughout the year, because, it's, you know, their work, their words, placed in the context of 2011 is still befitting for conversation and for comparison and contrast. And you know, Malcolm, you know, the great thing that I loved about Malcolm, and certainly I wasn't alive when he was alive, but from elders of mine and who are alive and fortunate enough to hear him speak live or from a distance, the thing that they said is that Malcolm, you know, spoke and empowered Black people. You know, at a time, you have to understand that white supremacy was still loud and clear. We still saw the ravages of Jim Crow. Given the fact that there actually had to be a second Voting Rights Act and a Civil Rights Act, lets you know. I mean, you're living in a very unjust society, in a very unjust country. The fact that they have to have a law passed to give segments of that population the right to have civil rights, the right to have voting rights. So, you know, Malcolm, you know, spoke power, and he placed things in terms of Black history and African history and the beauty of being Black, the beauty of being African, in great historical context and stroke power, without trepidation, that empowered a lot of Black folks to look inward and say, you know, despite what this hegemonic, you know, white supremacist society says of me and how we've been programmed to think that we are less than. It is a farce. It's a fallacy. It's untrue, and damn it, you know, this brother Malcolm has really inspired me to really embrace my Africanness, my Blackness. And Martin did the same thing,
in his own way. I want you to hear this real short clip. But Martin Luther King did the same thing in his own way, and this is also, you know, as Peter said, this is also not played very much, because they want us to you know, those of us that are of color, to believe, you know, to really buy into this post-racial society, to see ourselves as translucent, as nothing, because if they can take away your culture and rob you of your dignity, yet every day in school systems and even outside of school systems throughout America, white supremacy and Eurocentrism is celebrated from street signs to holidays to regular, you know, literature that is bantered across from public school to public school. But they want you, as a black and brown person, to believe and to feel that you're, you know, that you know, your race, your culture doesn't really matter. Just, you know, just being a good old American. Just be a good old American. In other words, be a good old handkerchief head Negro. So here's Dr. King. He's black and I'm proud.
I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. As somebody said earlier tonight, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure, high, and clean. But I want to get the language right tonight. I want to get the language so right that everybody here will cry out, yes, I'm black, I'm proud of it, I'm black and beautiful.
And that was Dr. King, and I, you know, I'll you know, touch on this and turn it back over to you, Peter. You know, folks, if it's not apparent to you right now, I mean, it should hit you in the face. You know, this show and before that, you know, it should hit us all in the face that, you know, our history, especially those of us who are indigenous, you know, Native Americans, those of us who are African, of African ancestry, if it hasn't hit you yet, they have rewritten our history. Their ploy, you know, and I say they. I'm talking about the apparatus of the U.S. government. You know, from everything from the corporate media to public school systems, have rewritten our history. Have taken it. Have even taken our greatest heroes and sheroes, and attempted to water them down, and then repackage them and sell them to the broader. The broader masses, you know, much like they did with hip hop, and resell it in a very very watered down, diluted way, so that you don't, that because if the masses, especially the masses of people of color,
how important it is for them to know of the complete complexity of Martin Luther King, the completeness of a Malcolm X, of a Fannie Lou Hamer, of an Ida B. Wells, the completeness of these individuals, and even individuals that are not from the stolen shores of America, looking at the Kwame Nkrumahs, the Julius Nyereres, and on the Samora Michelle, and we could go on and on, Queen Nzingas and the Nahandas. If we don't know of these individuals and their complete work, then we don't strive to psychologically liberate ourselves, our families, our communities. We don't begin to mobilize and strategize to empower ourselves to create stronger, more progressive organizations that advocate on behalf of us, our movement, our people. And that is what's going on. That is what's going on. That's why, you know, you have folks that are not so, I mean, what does it mean if America is mostly brown, you know, and mostly of color in 2050? What does it mean if those people have been watered down, the majority of those people have been watered down, and they still have no political or economic power to speak of? It means nothing. Did it mean anything in South Africa to have a white population that was the absolute minority in the 60s and 70s and 80s, you know what I'm saying, and going all the way back to the 1600s? Did it matter anything? No. No, it didn't matter anything whatsoever. They were the complete minority, and they put Azanians, black South African, native South Africans, in absolute hell for hundreds of years. So these are things that we need to keep in perspective. We cannot allow them to rewrite the history of folks like Dr. King. He was much more than some little soundbite that is always placed out of context. He is much more than that, much, much more than that. And the man was killed because he had the willingness to speak out against barbarity, to speak out against injustice, to speak out about crime, to call his country the greatest purveyor of violence on the face of the earth. What kind of guts that takes? And that's why you're not given that speech, because they don't want a bunch of black and brown skinned kids walking around thinking that and understanding in the true context of what their government is responsible for doing today in 2011, and speaking out in classrooms across America and vanguarding from grade to grade and taking that message and taking that ideology into different colleges, different communities. They do not want, that is their worst damn nightmare, to have that kind of mass of liberated black and brown skinned people, and even expanding that outwards to open-minded, poor, working-class white folks. You know what I'm saying? The poor working-class white folks that are stuck in their racism, fuck them. You know what I'm saying? But those that are open-minded enough to understand that how they're being oppressed by the same damn government, there's a place for them in the movement as well. So, Peter, you can take it.
Yeah. There's a lot there. That clip that we just heard, I think is a good example of King's embracing of black power. You know, I talked about how he was influenced, you know, by Malcolm X and by Bayard Rustin and A. Philip Randolph, and you added to that list, and then along comes Stokely Carmichael, later Kwame Ture, and the development of black power. And you know, the history books are, the mainline history books like to tell us that, you know, Martin Luther King was opposed to black power. You know, they paint this oppositional relationship, you know, between the likes of Malcolm and Martin. They place an oppositional relationship between Martin's nonviolent militant resistance and something like black power. Martin Luther King was not opposed to black power, not in the least. And that clip right there should underscore that reality. You know, listen to what he said. You know, he said, "Be proud of your heritage." You know, what he's saying is, be proud of your blackness. He stood there and said, "I'm black and beautiful." Now, this was in the 1960s, all right? You know, those were, you know, that's radical. That was a radical statement right there to say that. And just the fact that he said black and his increased use of the word black as he referred to people of color, black people, people of black heritage, as opposed to using the word Negro, which was standard for the day, is also reflective of Martin's evolution and his further move to the left, his philosophical progression. You know, he adopted that thinking, that radicalized thinking, and he began to, you know, use the language of black power and black radicalism and black nationalism. So Martin is not opposed to that or separated from it. Now, you know, the truth be told, he may have been opposed to black power as a strategy, you know, in 1966 when it first arose, as a potential mm-hmm. threat to, you know, diverting from the nonviolent resistance of the civil rights movement. So maybe there were some strategic differences, okay? But philosophically and spiritually, he embraced black power and what black power stood for, and that clip that you played just underscores that reality. For our listeners, I want to commend another author to you, another book to you, just so you can see it for yourselves in writing. One of the best books about Martin and Malcolm and their relationship to one another, because I really believe, Solomon, that we can only understand Malcolm in relation to Martin and Martin in relation to Malcolm. Particularly in their context in the 50s and 60s. And James Cone is the author to whom I refer. Cone is C-O-N-E. And the book that is authoritative is Malcolm and Martin and America. You know, get that book if you're listening now and you're not familiar with that. Get that book, Martin and Malcolm and America by James Cone. And I just want to read a brief quote from that book. Cone says, King was a political revolutionary. He transformed the social and political life of America. You would not have Barack Obama today if it had not been for King. Malcolm was a cultural revolutionary. He did not change the social or political structures, but he changed how black people thought about themselves. He transformed black thinking. End quote. Cone goes on to a little bit more, but for our purposes, that's enough. You know, so he states very, very, very clearly, point blank, King was a political revolutionary. Again, how many people today, Solomon, think of King as a revolutionary, all right? Because the caricature of King that's been painted since his untimely assassination wants to paint him as a pacifist and not as a revolutionary. I think most people would agree with the statement, Malcolm was a revolutionary. But we need to understand that King was a revolutionary also. Now, they were revolutionaries with different approaches, with different strategies, with different tactics, and even some divergence in their philosophies as it relates to their strategies. But they were both revolutionaries, and they were both absolutely necessary for the transformation and the liberation of black America that was underway in the 1960s. So, you know, that clip that you played is crucial in understanding where King stood philosophically and where he stood spiritually towards the end of his life, and how close he really was to your Malcolms and other radicals, and how he did in fact embrace black power. Now, think about this just for a moment. We can see a radicalization, and I've talked about that a couple times tonight, about the process of and the progression, the evolution of King. Just for argument's sake, just imagine if he had been allowed to live, if Malcolm had been allowed to live, if they'd both been able to keep their breath and into the 1970s and continue that evolution, what both of those characters, those individuals would have been like, those personalities would have been like by the time of, let's just say, 1980, when the conservative movement that began in early 1960s, largely as a backlash out of the civil rights gains, thanks to the likes of Martin and Malcolm and others, with Barry Goldwater, and then culminated in 1980 with the election of Ronald Reagan to the presidency. What if King and Malcolm had been around in 1980 and had the opportunity to be exposed to the evolution of black liberation thinking, and had the opportunity to have been exposed to the likes of the Black Panther Party, the likes of the theology, the liberation theology of James Cone, and other thinkers and other activists and other progressives. So what my point is that the king that the media and that our school books like to trot out once a year in January is a stale and incomplete caricature of a radical and revolutionary, a scholar as revolutionary, the real Martin Luther King. And so I can't stress that enough, and we really cannot stress enough how Martin would be opposed, vehemently opposed, to the crises that confront America today and the crises that confront black America today, not the least of which is that militarism that we've talked about and should continue to keep in front of us.
Right. And since you brought up black power, I think it's important, you know, to really put in context what black power is, you know.
Right.
Then Stokely Carmichael, you know, we're talking about books. A great book, if I can recommend to folks, is, you know, the great Stokely Carmichael, later changed the name to Kwame Ture, originally from Trinidad, you know.
All right.
Great book is Black Power, The Politics of Liberation in America,
right.
You know, which was a manifesto for blacks in America to embrace a new attitude towards civil rights. And within that book he wrote, and I want you people to listen to, this is kind of, you know, the genesis of him popularizing Black Power, because Black Power was also mentioned by Garvey and also Adam Clayton Powell. They spoke of Black Power as well. You know, many, many years before Carmichael, but Carmichael took it to another level and placed it in a context that became very, very popular within the black community. But he wrote in that book, Black Power is a call for black people in this country to unite, to recognize their heritage, to build a sense of community. It is a call for black people to begin to define their own goals, to lead their own lead their own organizations and to support those organizations. It is a call to reject the racist institutions and values of this society, being American society. And so, you know, when I say that, you know, we're looking at, you know, black people in America, no one would ever, I mean, going back to the so-called Revolutionary War, no one would have ever asked these so-called, you know, white folks who were here, everyone's pretty much accepted, you know, their right to fight off the so-called redcoats, you know, and Mother England, who had been persecuting them, and interesting enough, they came and persecuted, you know, the red man and as well as the black man and everything in between, but no one would ever. But so why is it such a taboo for someone to speak, to say, you know, black and brown people in this country need to collectively work together to empower themselves to have a political and economic base that is not reliant upon 501c3s. I was just talking to a good friend of mine, you know, who was Latina, about the importance of creating stronger organizations within, you know, the Latino community that as well as in the black community that are not incumbent upon federal dollars. You know, look at Acorn, for example. As soon as they started to step outside this box that Congress didn't, you know, wasn't comfortable with, you know, they pulled back their dollars and they folded, you know, and that's what happens. And you know, Garvey set the mold, you know, where he had an organization, the UNIA, that had the you know, the Black Cross Nurses, you know, you had Black Star Shipping Line, and these things, you know,
from the Black Star shipping line to his other endeavors, helped fund the Negro World newspaper, his other publications, Black Cross Nurses, and but the mold was set. I mean, that he wasn't dependent on the U.S. government. He wasn't dependent on some white folks. And so, coming back to King, King definitely believed in Black empowerment. And then beyond that, he started to take the message to also a class issue. And that's why I said before Peter spoke is that, you know, there are some poor white folks that just are they're going to live and they're going to die racist. They're going to, you know, they're going to die thinking Black folks and brown folks and red folks are inferior to them. And I have no itch within any of my makeup at this point in my life to try to go and convert some racist folks. Because people, you have these folks that these are like these mainstream Black folks, mainstream Latinos that think, we need to go and try to like work. No. I'm not trying to. No, that job that, if anyone's going to try to convert them, that job is up to progressive, radical-minded white folks to go in those own communities and do work with them to try to, but let's face it, some of them are just not going to be won over. But there are some that are not of that ilk, that are poor and understand that this is a class issue that connects Black and brown skin and poor white folks in very, very inextricable ways. And that's, so if folks would get their acts together, you know what I'm saying, and organize. I mean, you saw this and not buy into these corporate Democrat-backed nothingness marches. I mean, Peter, we had that conversation about the 10-10-10 march right, where so many people went down to the mall. You know, I wasn't – people were asking me. I'm like, no, I'm not wasting my time going down there. Nothing is going to come of it. People came and went back to their communities, whether it was Cleveland or Chicago or what have you, with no plan, no agenda whatsoever. There was no mold set. You know, there was no models set that, okay, this contingent, is going to connect with all these other organizations that within that are people that are within that city that are for universal health care. And you're going to go back with this model, and you're going to start to work with folks that you didn't even know existed in Chicago or Cleveland or Boston or have you towards this issue. It was to go march, and it's almost like a show and sell, like a pomp and circumstance. We have to take it to the next level. We have to take the organization, the organizing, the mobilization to a next level. We have to go to political training, and then with that political training, and political training is not Democrat, Republican, but it's how to control the politics of your community. Political training, city by block by block, community by community, and city by city, and state by state, and then start to mobilize these troops, and really start to look at forging progressive political parties. You know, maybe it's joining forces with the Green Party, which I have voted consistently with the last several years. Maybe it's creating a new independent political party. But there is space, despite they don't want you to think there's space, but there's space, and damn it, beyond space, there's absolute need to have a strong as hell progressive political party in this country. And right now, the closest thing to that is the Green Party. You can check that out at gp.org. Just check out their platform and see what it means to you. And if it piques your interest, then that's something you need to inquire about. But we need to move away from this model that we are just sycophants and just beloved, slaves to the Democratic Party and just voting for them blindly. Certainly not the Republican Party. But you can't just blindly vote for Democrats just because they're damn Democrats. If there's a progressive Democrat in your area that represents things that are important to you from a progressive standpoint, then you make the decision to support them. But you don't just vote for them just simply because they're Democrat, because most of the time they're going to sell you out. Most of the time those clowns are going to sell you out. And so, you know, Peter, those are things. And I want to read this other quote from Dr. King that plays to that, since we're paying homage to his life and legacy, and we can't truly feel comfortable with celebrating his life until, as John Judge was saying, you know, we have to look into solving this cold case around his assassination. But he said that this was 2 weeks before he passed away. Not passed away on his own, but had his life taken away. He said, it's a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages. Wow. I can hear the God of the universe saying, the children of my sons and daughters are in need of economic security, and you didn't provide for them. You cannot enter the kingdom of greatness. So he's basically saying that God's saying that, you know, to the U.S., you know, government, you didn't provide economic security for my sons and daughters. You cannot enter the kingdom of greatness. Basically saying that these people are damned because of that. And this is going on right now in much larger numbers per capita today. We are in an outright economic crisis that was caused by the rapaciousness and a fascist government that is in bed and has been in bed with corporations. And we look at, and Peter, I wanted to say this, and also Peter, he also said, a riot is the language of the unheard. He said a riot is the language of the unheard. So when the corporate media tries to pimp you, when you see people protesting as they did years ago in Seattle, Washington, over the WHO, you know, and the IMF and World Bank, and you saw them protesting. You know, the corporate media makes you feel like, you know, leads you to believe that these are just some radical hippies that just, you know, are just wayward. But no, look into why these people are protesting, and 9 times out of 10, it's stuff that actually benefits you. You know, but that's deep. A riot is the language of the unheard. But he damned, basically, in essence, if you read between the lines, was damning the U.S. government and saying they're not, that God would say you're not worthy to enter the kingdom of greatness because of what you have done to the poor folks within your society. And it is a fascist government that we are living in. And Peter, I'm going to turn it to you. But, folks, If you take all the money that was spent, all the money that was spent on the Civil War, that was spent on World War I, World War II, the Korean War, Vietnam, Desert Storm, all right, and even this current engagement that we're in, that the total amount tallies to around $12 trillion. The total amount tallies to about $12 trillion. Now, let's juxtapose that to the $12.8 trillion that were handed out, that was handed out by this government to the banksters on Wall Street, that was handed out to them, which they took the money, created some more phony money called derivatives, $23 trillion, around $23 to $27 trillion to be exact, created phony money with basically our tax dollars, because our tax dollars went to paying off the Goldman Sachs, the J.P. Morgans, and basically created all these credit default swaps. We see, you know, folks, you know, in places like Iceland who had sold out their people, who had done business with Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, and they crushed. It is damning. It is damning. That money could have gone towards keeping people in their homes. It could have gone towards getting people off the streets and into warm, affordable housing, all that stuff. So, Peter, we have about 8 minutes left. I know you have some thoughts on all this, but you know, Peter, just to me, it's just clear to me that there has to be some kind of social revolution. There has to be some kind of social revolution. I give a damn whether people are limited to thinking that, you know, that when someone says revolution, it just means violence. All right, revolutions don't have to be violent. They don't, they, you know, they, I'm not advocating violence or blood, you know what I'm saying? unless it's in self-defense. I'm not advocating any of that, but I'm saying there needs to be a social revolution where people need to come together, get their act together, and not in the mold that the white supremacist tea parties are talking about reclaiming their government, all right? But people have to claim their part of society, and right now it is not their part of society. Workers do not control their means to production, so people start on Monday and they can't wait till Friday because work is not, you know, thought of a creative process. It is just a bunch of drones, a bunch of slaves going through. They don't control the means. They don't have any say over the production of what they're producing for the vast majority of people out there, all right? And because of that, you know, you have this country produced last year something like, I believe it was something like 75 or more new millionaires. But at the same token, the poor got poorer, but the rich get richer. What do you say, Peter?
That is the American ethos, Solomon. The rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer, the little guy getting stepped on. And we, you know, to kind of wrap this up and try to make some sense of it in a big picture, you know, Martin Luther King was opposed to those kind of American ideals that are destructive to the human person and to human community. And unfortunately, when you talk about a social revolution, I agree with you 100%. We absolutely need a social revolution. Martin Luther King said we need a revolution of values, because it's a revolution of values that will pave the way for a revolution of social reality in this country. But unfortunately, Americanism does not value things like community and equality and justice. And despite what the rhetoric is, despite what people say, and despite what all these patriotic and jingoistic songs that, you know, people sing at the beginning of sports games and all this other crap, despite the rhetoric and despite the language, the real values based on the behaviors that we see do not lead to community, and they do not lead to justice. They do not lead to wholeness and wellness and happiness. But they lead to destruction and agony and death. And unfortunately, that is the American ethos. And you're right, it can only be changed through some kind of social revolution. That's our only option. And even King said towards the end of his life, you know, this is a guy who was eternally optimistic, but he said to his wife at one point, he said, you know, the nation is too sick. And he even foresaw his own assassination, because he realized that, you know, the nation is so divided. You know, we talk about how divided the nation is in 2011 with, you know, some of the political events, particularly since Barack Obama's election. But that's not anything new. Maybe it's a little more intense now. Maybe it's much more obvious to us because of media and technology and so forth. But Martin Luther King realized that, too. He realized... in fact, there was a book written, I forget the year, but I mean, you know, during King's lifetime about, you know, two nations, you know, the United States is two nations. W.E. Du Bois called it, you know, in, was it 1906, Souls of Black Folks, you know, the problem of the 20th century would be the color line. It's still a problem today. Andrew Hacker wrote a book in the 1990s called Two Nations. You know, so there's this real sense that this is a divided nation, and there are those of us who do hold a different value system, but unfortunately, you know, the regressive forces for whom Martin Luther King was enemy number one. I mean, he was public enemy number one, you know, for these transnational corporations and for the American government and for the, you know, the military industrial system, which is why he had to be taken out. You know, he stood in the way of their inexorable consolidation of power and their control over of the minds and the lives of human beings. And, you know, he fought against that. And we need to fight against that. You know, we need to strive for that revolution that you just called for, that Martin Luther King was calling for, that Malcolm was struggling for. Going all the way back to, you know, obviously there's a litany of individuals of this continuity of consciousness of struggle, and And so I'll let you close out the show, Solomon.
I'm not going to close out. I'm going to let MLK close out.
All right.
We have a minute left, and folks, you have the email, yourworldnews2010@gmail. Hit us up. I hope my brother that called in from Virgin Island hits us up so we can set that show up in the future. And just send this link. We just ask you, send the link to every one of your contacts. Have them listen to this program, not just this episode, but there's a wealth of information that's on our site. And so here's Dr. King. Until next time, for Peter Fowler, I'm Solomon, Your World News.
We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory.